session, we were off record 5:50. No decisions were made in executive session, so is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. All right, welcome to 6 p.m. City Council meeting Tuesday, February 28th. I'd like to introduce the meeting and acknowledge that the press and public were duly notified of the meeting in accordance with the Freedom of Information Act. Join me in standing for the invocation to be followed by the Pledge of Allegiance. Father, we thank you for the day. Thank you for the beautiful weather. Thank you for this opportunity of service. Help us to keep the greater mind and good as we walk through business tonight. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Nicole, roll call.
Councilmember Hahn?
Here.
Councilmember Myers?
Here.
Councilmember Ward?
Here.
Councilmember Streetman?
Here.
Councilmember Popson?
Here.
Councilmember Anderson?
Here.
Councilmember Pierce?
He's
on Zoom.
These are on.
Mayor Pounds?
Here.
You have a quorum?
Okay, we're not on. Thank you. First time, I'd like to suspend the rules of order to allow our Lovello presenters to go now instead of waiting until after citizens' comments.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. With us tonight is Mel Blakey, Project Director for Lovello.
Well, I'm actually not Mel.
All right.
I'm
well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Just be sure you're into the mic really well.
Thank you so much. I'm Debbie Bordeaux, and I'm the Director of Development of the Hollings Cancer Center at MUSC. And with me today, I have Abby, who is here from our partner Medalist, that helps us execute the event. But I just wanted to start out by saying thank you so much on behalf of the Hollings Cancer Center and all of our cancer patients for helping us raise $1.5 million to support cancer research at MUSC. With Lovello 2022. We are really excited to be moving forward with our partners, Medalist, on a Lovello 22, or 23, excuse me. I can just go ahead.
Yes.
Just, all right, great.
Talk loud.
Anyway, we hope that you will consider sponsoring our ride once again. The partnership with the Isle of Palms has been so tremendous and has really allowed us to build this ride to the ride that we were able to produce last year with over 891 riders and raising, as I said, $1.5 million. I know we are not the top of the ticket here, but of all of you here tonight, Lovello is a fundraising bike ride that supports the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center, and we start and stop at Isle of Palms, and we're just really excited about highlighting this community and having us all come together to support cancer research.
Questions? This will be November 4th is the date of the...
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor. Yeah. Let me say something. Debbie had tapped me a couple of years ago to serve on their board. To
kind of help put things together when they were first thinking about coming out of Isle of Palms. And this is a fine group to work with. And, of course, the... You know, the calls, I mean, for MUSC, Kick Hollings Cancer Service, and all of the funds going to them, I mean, that's just a great cause. And I really enjoyed being a part of not only your committee and helping put this together, but also attending. In fact, the rainy year, 2 years ago, I actually participated, and that was not good. But anyway, thank you so much. You know, for everything that you do, and I'm wholeheartedly in support of us when we get to decision time of moving forward with this. I mean, this also is an event that takes place during the shoulder season, first week in November, and it is a great opportunity to pull some additional visitors to the island and some that may stay overnight, these riders. Thank you.
Okay. I, too, think it's a wonderful event that you have. I just have one question. I read your proposal, which I thought was very thorough. You mentioned that you want to shut down Front Beach starting the Thursday before the event and reopen Sunday morning. So it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Is there any way that could be shortened so that maybe one lane of the road through Front Beach could be remain open? Has there been a discussion with the business people about that?
I think this is what we've done in the past last couple of years. Yeah.
And there's no complaints from the business community in Front Beach?
Yeah, so we only shut down one side, so the northbound onto 14th will still remain open throughout the whole weekend.
The Front Beach, though, Ocean Boulevard.
Oh, Ocean Boulevard, there will still be a one-way direction around to get back to.
Okay, that's all I asked.
It actually brings businesses that time of year, business to the local businesses that time of year probably wouldn't be getting as much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming tonight.
Mayor, we do need a motion to approve it as a city-sponsored event for November 4th.
Motion to approve.
Second. Sponsored it.
Seconded it. Any other discussion or questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ray. All right, we're back up to citizens' comments. Nicole.
Glenda Nemus.
Good evening. Glenda Nemus. I'm a full-time resident. I'm here to speak about an item that's kind of hidden in the agenda tonight, and it's the ATAX revisiting of our DMO. And it's the last item on new business, and I'm sure you'll be all quite tired by then. In the packet was included an attorney general's opinion about whether or not we could choose our own DMO. And I would like to put some clarity around that attorney's opinion, with a note, around the attorney's opinion. It is just that. The State Treasurer's Department's attorney did look at that, and several of us on the island have had conversations with that attorney that says he does not believe it would hold water in court. I would like to propose that our ATAX DMO that we currently use is a regional marketing organization, and their money is mostly spent on regional marketing. We do gain some benefit from that. But our needs are really for a local marketing for Isle of Palms. We've gotten big enough and busy enough now that we need to take our money and spend it directly and have more decision-making over it. I'd like to just give you an example of where our money goes when we use CBB as our DMO. And this is not to fault them. They're a regional marketer. Here is the destination guide that they give out. It's a very expensive publication. In there, you'll see two little marks here where Isle of Palms is mentioned twice. It's a 250-page book, and we have two tiny mentions in it. We pay for 25% of this book. And that's because CBB has done a calculation that says that we have on Isle of Palms 25%, 24% of the lodging in the region. Yet we're not even mentioned in this book. In the back is a wedding guide that's 150 pages. And I searched through it and I found 6 tiny little mentions in it, about an inch, and they're all for Wild Dunes. Not a one mentions our short-term rentals. And our short-term rentals produce 84% of our ATAXes that are paying for this, based on the fact that we have 25, I'm not sure where they got the figure that we have 25% of the regional lodging. So our money could be better spent not on regional marketing with publications like this. And the way we do that is to follow the Folly Beach model. And it hasn't been studied by this council yet, and I'm suggesting that it be studied and looked at. It's very easy to do.
Ms. Nina said you wrap this up.
And that is what this is about. It's about looking at the ATAX DMO, making the best use of our money, and not just passing it off. Thank you very much.
Holly Weston.
Hi, good evening. I'm Polly Judson, and I live at 3800 Cameron Boulevard. Thank you to the council for your hard work. We do appreciate it, and I also appreciate the opportunity to speak to you tonight. I have 3 points to make, addressing three recent narratives that have been bubbling around the community. The first is about LLCs. The second is about Folly Beach and residential character. And the third is about the toilet paper effect.
Sandy, credit to you too.
First, please know that the hundreds of LLCs registered as short-term rental properties are people like my husband and me. They're residents, many of them, and they are not greedy corporations. If you own a house and you rent it even for a couple weeks a year, it is prudent to have an LLC, a limited liability corporation, is what it's called, to limit your liability in case a renter sues you. So this is not like all these big-time investors coming in. It's really about me. It's about residents. It's about people who happen to rent their homes. And some of them, like us, we rent them for more than 72 days a year, but we're also permanent residents here. I haven't seen where we fit into your puzzle when I read the proposals this afternoon. We don't fit. And I think I would suggest there's probably a lot of people who don't fit perfectly in some model. So I think that's really important. The second is that we're not Folly Beach. Everybody's running around saying that they're having caps, so we should too. And we rented on Folly Beach for 3 months, February, March, and April, a few years ago. Folly is very different from the Isle of Palms. It's like the Wild West compared to us. And I don't say that disparagingly. I really don't. It's just very different, very free spirit, very few rules that we could observe, and people seem to have more of an everyman for himself when it comes to rentals and even zoning. We also think, my husband and I know some neighbors agree that one of the big problems is not about short-term rentals, it's about big houses taking over from little houses. We all know that every week another J.C. Long house goes down and a big three-story, five-bedroom, six-bedroom house goes up with a pool. And they might live there full-time. They might live there part-time. They might rent it. But no matter what, the character of the neighborhood changes when you take away a little house and you put a big house into the place. The third point that I would like to make is about toilet paper. And that is, there are some people who seem to think...
Ms. Judson, you're going to have to make that point short, please.
Okay. Some people seem to think that all of this race to get rental licenses is because there's new investment in the community. And I would suggest it's the toilet paper effect, where people, when we had COVID, we all ran out and stocked up on toilet paper. Why? So we wouldn't run out. And in this case, what's happened is a lot of owners have run out to get STR licenses so that they won't have to worry about being left out should you all put a cap in, because you've talked a lot about it for the past year. And I think people would really like us to move on. Thank you.
Hi, Bev Miller, 3 Fairway Village Lane. I previously talked about on behalf of Barrier Island Preservation Alliance. Tonight I'm talking for Bev Miller, resident, so I'm unfiltered, so be ready. I hope tonight brings closure to what has become a long, divisive road to stemming the rising trend of unfettered access to short-term rental licenses in our city. I'm disturbed first by the underlying data cited by some council members as to why a cap is not necessary.
The message from the 3 listening sessions is that residents do not want a cap. just enforcement. So I thought I'd get the data as to who attended, the number of residents, the industry reps, the Wild Dunes Resort reps, and only the list from the first listening session is available because the attendance lists from the last two sessions were accidentally thrown away. The one that exists is incomplete. One resident is listed twice. Of the 21 walk-ins, one had only a first name and the other 20 had only a first and last name. I was there. Names were checked off in attendance, that's good, but others I know who were there are not on the list. No blame line. I'm not casting blame. The point is that there is no data, so how could that possibly be used as a data point for a decision? The petition on change.org requires only a last name, a first name, and an email address. Have all of you seen the names on that list? I'm guessing not. Anyone from anywhere in the country who does not believe in any kind of moratorium and any kind of cap on STRs could sign it, and I assume they did. Again, why is that a data point? I'm also disturbed by the argument that holding a short-term rental license is a property right. We all enjoy the right to rent our homes. To rent it out on a short-term basis, however, requires a license. If you set a cap and somehow that cap is reached, the homeowner has a right to rent it out long-term. It's not government's job to ensure that a rental nets an owner a certain profit. A license is not a right. That's a CTAR narrative. This has been asked before. What harm is there in a cap? I see it as a guardrail, an insurance policy. Granicus is faulty by admission that I heard, yet we read and hear that 1,200 STR licenses is a valid number. If that's true, why not cap licenses outside of the Front Beach commercial district at 1,400? If you truly believe we have only 1,200 active licenses, buy the insurance policy that allows the city to remain the residential community it is now. We'll have it and may never need it. Don't wait until after the natural disaster happens to buy the policy. Residents are asking for a balance, and more importantly, asking you for leadership. Not personal agendas, not personal feelings, but for a decision based on real data that brings us quality of life and livability in this paradise we call home. Vote tonight so residents can move on, because we're in it for the long haul. Thank you.
I'm Hallie Pfeiffer. I'm a full-time resident. I'd like to explore this idea that we don't need short-term rental caps because market forces will maintain the status quo. Pardon my cynicism, but anyone who says they know what any market will do in the future is either speculating or trying to sell you something. Markets are reactive. They respond to economic factors like supply and demand, regulation and deregulation, interest rates, inflation, recession. For example, if Isle of Palms becomes the only community in the surrounding area with no limit on short-term rental licenses, that's a supply and demand issue. Will the market react? Who knows? Will today's high interest rates and skyrocketing home prices scare off both homeowners and investors? Or will it leave corporate concerns who can leverage assets to pay cash as the only ones who can afford to buy property here? What if the laissez-faire approach to STR lease distribution leads to a glut of rental properties? Typically, markets respond with more vacancies and downward pressure on rental income. And if rentals are no longer profitable, watch what happens to property values when investors decide to write off their losses and look for more lucrative ventures. Definitely not a good situation when you're depending on those rents to subsidize your vacation home. Without caps, we could be looking at an epic disaster, or nothing may happen at all. The only real fact in all of this is we have absolutely no clue, none of us. So just for a moment, let's set aside our personal opinions and agendas and look at this issue from a purely practical standpoint. As was mentioned earlier tonight, how can anyone honestly object to a precautionary measure that would act as an insurance policy against all of this? Establishing short-term rental caps is not a risky or revolutionary move. Communities all across the country are doing it. So why the dithering? If we are to believe that market forces are enough to keep the balance we have now, then why all this worry about a cap that will never be an issue? If the practicalities of my argument don't persuade you, let me take a more human approach. The house next door to us went on the rental market 3 years ago, and we're now subjected to poolside screaming and yelling that's so loud it penetrates double-paned hurricane windows. Sometimes this goes on from sunup to sundown every day for weeks on end. The impact to our quality of life is undeniable. but no one seems particularly interested in helping. Perhaps it's because all parties to whom might appeal for remedy are profiting from this arrangement. Those of you on the council whose minds are already made up are probably pretty sick of hearing from us, and I feel you. The last thing I want to be doing right now is standing here begging my own city council not to sell out their neighbors, especially when so many ran on a residents first platform. Maybe you don't care. Maybe you said what you had to say to get elected just to accomplish this very thing. Well, I can assure you of one major accomplishment in this council's tenure. You now have my undivided attention.
Sandy Robinson.
I've lived on Isle of Palms for 30 years as of next month, and I'm here to speak in favor of limiting short-term rental licenses. You've heard our concerns about increased noise and traffic and litter, about parking issues, about diminished quality of life, and about loss of community without action to establish reasonable limits on licenses. One concern I haven't heard about is water quality. As a chair of the Environmental Advisory Committee, I shared with council results of recent water quality sampling from drainage ditches after rainfall in areas where homes have septic tanks. E. coli bacteria levels were so high they couldn't be measured in most samples. The finding is likely related to rise in the water table after rainfall, leaving inadequate filtering of wastewater before it reaches groundwater. The water in the ditches makes its way to the coastal waters and can impact health. More people in larger short-term rental homes produce more wastewater and more potential for bacterial contamination. The Isle of Palms Planning Commission recommended that we take steps regarding limiting short-term rentals. Several years ago, our city administrator and our director have worked tirelessly to provide us with data and maps to show from 2010, 2015, and 2020 that have illustrated the growth of short-term rentals over this time. We must take action to preserve the Isle of Palms, and I'd like to express my support for Councilman Pierce's clear, manageable, and residents-first proposal for four reasons. One is it does not limit resident licenses. Two, it does not impact current licenses and revenue streams. Three, it limits investor licenses to the historically 33% that we've heard about and requires investors to generate a specified amount of income in order to prevent hoarding. And four, it prevents cherry picking of what is called a residence and what is not. Lastly, I wanted to address the one-sentence petition signed by 600 people who reportedly oppose caps. A quick review of the petition revealed signatures from Mount Pleasant, Charleston, and duplicate signatures. My background is healthcare. When we seek approval for an intervention, we obtain informed consent. This includes an explanation of the issue and the benefits and the risk before someone is asked to sign. No such explanation was provided to inform signees, and no effort was made to determine if signees were registered voters or not. Please thoughtfully consider protecting residents from unlimited commercial enterprises in our neighborhoods. As an elected official, your willingness to reflect on our feedback and find solutions that serve all residents is true public service.
Brian Duffy, 3613 Waterway Boulevard. Good evening, Council, and thank you, Ms. Brotherton, for taking a piece of my action, but that's okay, because tonight...
I'm about due diligence, data and due diligence. For more than 60 days, we have been hearing from some of you over and over again about 600-plus do-nothing petitioners, which seems to have informed your action, or is it inaction? So I went looking for this petition and found it on the city website, and doing my due diligence, all I can say is wow. My interest was piqued, and the website was checked for the December 6th council meeting minutes, but they are unavailable.
So it was off to the December 6th meeting video to find out where did that do nothing petition number come from. I found it. Upon petition submittal, council was told, quote, we are still validating our online petition numbers, but I do have some, close quote. That's a red flag. Continuing to peel back the onion, I contacted the County Board of Elections, the responsible party for any petition validation, and asked the county, does the county accept online petition? And the answer was no. So now what? 60 days plus from submittal, anticipating addendums to the Do Nothing petition, I checked and found none. So I have to ask, why are some of you so attached to the number of Do Nothing signatures? I have my thoughts, but first, the analysis of the Do Nothing petition. These are the data. There were 232 unique signatures, 10 were not residents, 50 were without birthdays, and 13 with no addresses. From a Board of Elections perspective, that is only 222 possibly valid signatures. Obviously, not the number that was repeated over and over again. All it took was a little due diligence and data examination. My original question remains, why the attachment to the do nothing number? But now I have to ask, why no due diligence on your part? Ronald Reagan even said, trust, but verify. As for my thoughts, I think I will keep them to myself.
Because as a grown-up, I choose to manage my emotions and let the data and due diligence speak for itself. Thank you.
Stephen Goodwin.
Good evening. Apologize if I shout. I have microphone issues. My name is Stephen Goodwin. I'm an IOP business owner. I'm a Folly Beach business owner and a Charleston resident. I come to you direct from Folly Beach, where we've been exposing the lies and misrepresentations of the NIMBY crowd on Folly Beach, who apparently moved to South Carolina not realizing it is a vacation destination. Who knew? Well, Gershwin knew. He wrote Porgy and Bess in a vacation home in South Carolina in 1934. That's nearly 100 years ago. Tourism is a $24 billion a year activity here in South Carolina. Vacation rentals, as you heard earlier, are about 25% of that number, driven by people's desire to be near the beach. Now, no one knows who's funding these shadowy organizations. We have representatives of BEPA, Preserve IOP, and their Pathfinder, my particular favorite, Mr. John McFarlane, for Save Folly's future. His goal is to create a private island for his own personal enjoyment. That's not in doubt. He said it. I've got the emails. I've got the video. I can show you the links. Short-term renters and day trippers are to be demonized and not welcomed. Eliminating all short-term rentals is their stated goal. They didn't start that way. They started by saying, it's a noise issue. Well, we debunked their noise issues. We debunked their trash issues. All of those can be solved through sensible ordinances. It was only at the end of that campaign that it came out that they actually truly want to create a private island. We understand that visitors to the island, both renters and those here for a day out, should conduct themselves in a respectful and orderly manner. We support enforcement of sensible ordinances to ensure the beach is a safe and fun place for all. I have to say, throughout this process, council has been exemplary. I served on your pandemic committee, which set sensible standards for reopening rentals, despite these same protectionist voices demanding that their private island experience become normalized. We've seen the emails. It started in 2020. They wanted that to continue. Council has held listening sessions and heard that the focus should be enforcement. That is supported by the 156-page Kim Lee Horn
professional study on the housing market in Kiowa who have examined this issue. It states that rentals are value-enhancing if safety and noise are controlled. The city can manage those two issues competently and professionally. But this isn't enough for the mob. They're acting like five-year-old children that won't be ignored until they get their way. Often, they're newly arrived authoritarian residents, small in number, loud in voice.
Mr. Goodwin, I'll need you to wrap up your comments, please.
Okay, I've got 20 seconds. Are pushing for unconstitutional restrictions on property owners driven by their self-interest. The 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a similar ordinance that favored 4% residents over 6% property owners as violating the Interstate Commerce Clause. It's time to put these people back in their place and give them a time out. They're the same people that would move to Montana and complain that the cattle there moo. A cap will have unpredictable consequences. It's in the Kimley-Horn report. Don't let them set residents against residents, islanders against the rest of the state. Save us from the litigation that Folly Beach is embroiled in. Vote no to any cap and let's focus on sensible enforcement. Thank you very much.
Michael Bailey. James Ray.
Good evening. Thank you for your time. I'm Michael Bailey. I live over on Forest Trail. Just a few quick points. We're against any short-term bans or moratoriums as proposed. We don't want anything done with the short-term rentals outside of managing noise and issues to make them good neighbors. One of the issues, you know, what we see on the island here with the traffic, crowded beaches, litter, all that, it's on the weekends. And if you look at the short-term rentals, 90 to 93% occupancy during the summertime, no matter the day of the week. There isn't a flood of short-term rentals on the weekends. It's the day trippers that are flooding us on the weekends. We have a day tripper issue, not a short-term rental issue. The biggest winner, if we do a short-term rental moratorium, ban, whatever, the biggest winner is going to be the Wild Dunes Resort. It will drive up their occupancy rates and encourage them to build more. And we're already fighting Wild Dunes in a lawsuit. We're going to get more lawsuits if we enact this ban. We need to keep our eye on the ball and concentrate on the one issue we have down in Wild Dunes with the Lowe Corporation. In closing, we need to do something about the day tripper issue. It's not a simple issue. I'm not saying to close the beaches to the day trippers, but that's what we need to concentrate our energies on, not the short-term rentals. Thank you.
If you'd like, you can need to stay in the time.
Oh, sorry, I was
my job.
Need a motion to allow further citizen comments.
Motion to allow further comments.
Second. All in favor say aye.
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 James Ray? No. Mr. Klaus?
Thank you. My name is Al Klaus, and I live at 3 Grand Pavilion. Talking about the proposed noise ordinance that's in your packet today. It does not work for a number of IOP residents. It is discriminatory, unconscionable, and narcissistic. We have repeatedly stated commercial properties, such as the Sweetgrass Inn, located in residential neighborhoods, are to be carved out of traditionally identified commercial property designations, resulting in 3 classifications, not 2. Our administrators are recommending 70 DBAs for all commercial properties as compared to 60 DBAs for residential properties. Now, 70 DBAs are 10 times louder than 60 DBAs. We are not Kiowa. 2,000 residents on 12 and a half square miles, compared to 4,000 IOP residents on 4.5 square miles. Big difference. We are not the Windjammer, a commercial property located in a commercial area. We contend a new noise ordinance should not have any negative impact on the Windjammer, an IOP icon. Common sense tells you commercial properties located in a residential community are to be held at a higher standard. What is the reason our administrators are in denial? They continue to place square pegs in round holes. This is not a one-size-fits-all situation. Proposed draft definitions. Based on our experience the past 2 years, they continue to be wishful window dressing, no enforcement, a double standard. We do not allow loudspeakers in our parks. However, we allow them adjacent to residential neighborhoods. Permits for additional amplification in the proposed ordinance, letter H. A full page describing how the fox is going to guard the hen house, allowing 85 dBAs, an administrative nightmare. No bonding requirements, no verbiage regarding the residents' rights, remedies, or recourse. Arguably acceptable for a commercial property. However, not a commercial property located in a residential neighborhood.
Mr. Foss. Come back with your comments, please.
I'm sorry. Don't I get any slack on the microphone?
I'm sorry.
Remember the STR listening sessions. Number one issue, noise. The NIH, the EPA, and the WHO state prolonged exposure to environmental noise levels above 70 dBAs leads to permanent hearing loss. The EPA recommends maximum indoor noise level of 45 dBAs, maximum outdoor noise level of 55 dBAs. This is us, a mixed-use property. This is us. Go to the minutes, if you would, please, Public Safety Committee meeting minutes, dated 1/26/23 and 2/14/24. For additional detail and amplification of what we're talking about here.
Valerie Krause.
She's
not here. Laura Lovins.
It's coming in and out. We don't understand what's happening.
Okay. Laura Lovins, Five Links, Clubhouse Villas, Wild Dunes. It's clear that the issue of STR caps or lack thereof is a divided issue among the residents of IOP. There are many voices of who want caps, and there are many voices that want some form of caps to be instituted, and there are others that want no caps at all. What is not clear to me is why all the voices on the topic are not being heard and some form of compromise can't be reached. I was asked yesterday why enforcement of STRs can't be considered a part of quality of life for residents. I've been thinking about that question ever since then, and here is my answer. Enforcement of an STR does not solve the root problem. Continued growth of STRs by investors here on IOP. That's the root problem. Enforcement is the very least we should expect from our city in the way of protection for our quality of life. In this scenario, enforcement alone does not provide sustainable quality of life because when another investor buys what was a single-family home a block away or two blocks away, and turns it into a mini hotel, they are bringing more traffic, more trash to our beaches, more noise, and continuing the cycle of unlivability and turning our neighborhoods into commercial districts. When a surgeon is faced with a patient who is bleeding out, he or she does not wait to see if the bleeding will stop on its own. And it's been suggested that, well, there's only 1,200 active licenses. We should just wait and see. He or she does not put a bandage on the gushing wound. The patient is rushed to the OR to find out what the root cause of the bleed is and fix it. My voice and many others like me are asking that this council be forward-thinking and build resiliency into our city's plan for the future now, not later. And resiliency is also part of your mission statement. Please work with the STR plan that Councilman Pierce has put forward and be proactive and resilient to both sides of the issue. Thank you very much.
Green and Bell.
Tell I didn't plan this, I wouldn't be this far down the list. So I'm going to make it brief. I've sat up there long enough to know this decision's already been made. There's five votes sitting up here that will either do nothing or pass a cap that's meaningless. I kind of laugh at the data and the data discussions. I spent 9 years as a vice president of information management at Hewlett-Packard, and I'll tell you, if I use the data that's being used and put it in front of my management, I'd be fired. Because it's not quality data. The 600 is a joke. We don't know whether it's 1,200 or 1,700. The reality is no caps, and I apologize to Hallie for not remembering her last name, but she's dead on. We don't know what the market's going to do. It's not going to shrink. It's going to increase over time. If you're the only dry sponge in a puddle, we will be absorbing whatever demand that is, be it small or be it large. It's going to happen. It has happened endlessly over time. And I've been coming to this island for 30-something years. I've lived here for going on 10. I've watched the changes. I sat up here for 4 years. What is stunning to me is the lack of thoughtful debate amongst this council for proposals that need to be discussed in front of the public and vetted for their accuracy or just consideration. To read the mayor's comments about 1,200, purporting that that's the number, it's not the number. Granite Coast was brought in while I sat up there. It is a tool to be used. It is not to set the facts around how many rentals we have on this island. So I would encourage council to have some thoughtful debate. One thing I do know, this community is more organized than I've ever seen it. If this council fails to act appropriately, I'll take the over and under on how quick it takes to get the 680-something signatures to put this to a referendum, which I think will embarrass the city. There's no point to it. We don't need a referendum. We need responsible discussion and council action on something that's been kicked down the road for God knows how many years. Thank you.
Santiago, 60 Ocean Point. If anybody wants to put money up, I'll double it for a new AV system. Cut you a check right now. 4 months ago, you passed the PRD 5 ordinances. There was a lot of skepticism when I first brought up the concept of there being the willpower of the residents, the voting residents, to back you. You had that skepticism, and I understood it. The citizens hadn't rallied around things before this. But every meeting was packed, here, up there. When we finally got to the end, you woke up and realized that there is the willpower. We are fed up. This island is over capacity. We all know it. We live with it. It's just the reality. And we can't get divided. I said it before. I'll say it again. One person comes up here and they blame who? The day trippers. Somebody else blames the dark low resort. Somebody else blames the STR. The reality of it is they all contribute to this. It's just common sense. We have to take all three and address them. There's only so much parking. There's a point you have to say no. There's only so many short-term rentals you can absorb. You have to get at some point say no. The resort can only develop so many more rooms. You have to say no. Guys, you can't just kick the can. You have to make a policy, a reasonable one. Short-term rentals are going to have to be capped to some degree, period. It's illogical to think otherwise. The resort had to be capped. If you don't cap the short-term rentals and you kick the can and you don't put any caps or you do a very watered down one, guess who's going to exploit that against you in their lawsuit and in the case? Dartlow is. They're going to say, why us? Why are you picking on us? You got the day trippers. You got the short-term rentals. You ignore them. Go ahead and give them the ammunition. Trust me, they'll use it. Keep in mind, they still have the Cooper Hotel they have investments in to bring people here. Did anybody pay attention to what they're doing on the peninsula in Charleston? You should be worried about that with Lowe, really. They've got $500 million that they're going to put on a property, and they got the inside track on it. It's the pier on the peninsula, the whole beautiful area. They want 7-story hotels and condos there. Where do you think they're going to ship those people when they want to come to the beach? When they want to do a convention here? Open the door with the short-term rentals and Dartlow will jump in on you. Guarantee it. Do not send them messages. Mayor Pounds, please do not talk about negotiating the minute a lawsuit hits. We will be able to give you feedback. If you want to, I challenge you to open the rec center again and see how many people come out there in support of some reasonable caps, not crazy stuff. We're not trying to hurt our residents here. Councilman Pierce is the best one to start with. Don't say it's the end all. You'll negotiate. But don't make us have to do a referendum, because nobody should take that bet. Randy will win it, guaranteed. Thank you.
Jeffrey Corcoran.
Sorry.
He's not coming.
Okay. He's the last one.
Thank you all for speaking and signing up. Are we all right?
I'm sorry. I signed up and got
an
email back.
I'm sorry. Okay. There were so many people. She probably did.
Come on up.
Just want to stand by. So, hang on. Let's get her first.
Okay, her first.
Yeah. Ladies first. Sir.
Thank you.
Move the mic so when it starts working, you'll be there.
My name's Shelley Miles, and I own Exclusive Properties, and I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about my story. So we moved here to the island in 2003 with my husband and my 3 small children at the time. We loved living on the island and raising our children here. Our initial intention was to rent our home out in the summer and travel with our family. Once our home was finished, there was no way that I wanted other people renting our home, living in my house, sleeping in my beds, using my toilet, if you can imagine. So we decided we weren't going to do that. In 2008, when the housing market was tanking, our financial situation changed. We were not sure if we would be able to afford to stay in our home, and we didn't know what to do. My husband and I were in development, and I was managing some homes already at the time on the island. We felt very blessed and fortunate that we were able to move out of our home and start renting it and sharing it with other families. I can't imagine if we were in that situation today and if we weren't able to rent our home out. We still own a home here, but as a rental. But we sold our primary home in February, but we continue to rent it for the new owner. And as I said earlier, I own exclusive properties. I manage about 30 homes for homeowners. As a property manager, I strive to maintain the property as if royalty were coming to the house. I also am very hands-on regarding how I reach out to the neighbors who live around the homes that I manage. And I share my cell. I want to make sure that those neighbors that are around the home that I manage have my contact. So if something's going on, I'm there to take care of it. I want that to happen. I'm very hands-on. And I know that most of the property management companies here, too, probably are in that same boat, that they're like that, too. I'm not saying that there aren't issues that happen. I've had neighbors that have called me. I had one neighbor who called me. She was from California. She was actually babysitting. She came from California, was babysitting in the home where her son and daughter-in-law owned it. And she called because of one of our houses and the noise that was going on in the back pool. I immediately went down to the house, which I already knew the homeowner was there. I went down to the house, and it was the homeowner, of course, I knew that, and I just explained what had happened with the neighbor. And I went to the neighbor and afterwards and told her what I had done, and she said she's never seen anything like it, was so thankful, didn't have another problem.
Ms. Moss.
Problems happen, I know, gosh. So, real fast. So, what I really wanted to talk to you about is, we know there's problems. We know that trash bothers you, noise bothers you. It would bother me too when I lived here. Can we make some rules, like get more, those people who have rental licenses, can they have more trash cans? Can they pay a larger amount of money so that it doesn't impact the financially for the city? Can we pay extra to have those? I'm sorry, I know I'm running out of time, so. I'm not sure what the answer is here and what you all need to do, but I do know that I would hate for someone to not have the opportunity to be able to rent their home. I just know that it would have been terrible in our case, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Hi there, my name's Tom Schmidt. I live at 50 Ocean Point Drive. Looks like I'm the last in Mohicans tonight. I'm going to need an extra 5 minutes or so because of the microphone.
We'll give you three.
I got good news and bad news. The good news is tonight is decision night. The bad news is tonight is decision night. This workshop approach has not been a process. It has been and continues to be a FUBAR, which is a military expression that's pretty widely known. It's apparent to your former constituents that the council is being held hostage by five obstreperants or obstructionists. And so we've been talking out here for weeks, a month and a half, and tonight's not going to change your mind. We know that. It's apparent to the residents that Councilmen Anderson, Bogosian, Mayors, and Pierce have been working toward building council census on a comprehensive STR cap. We feel, I think, pretty unitedly that Scott Pierce's, and I got to have extra time because Scott and I disappeared, proposal seems to weigh a lot of things. Is the mayor working to affect an STR cap as those who voted for him are demanding? Apparently not. Contrary to the mayoral candidate's well-weighted election campaign, which highlighted leadership, problem-solving, unity building, and being resident-centered, we now witness a mayor seated in council workshops, not leading, guiding, or offering solutions in the workshops, also known as Kabuki Theater. What will happen this evening?
most likely nothing. Or at the very worst, the pre-rig council will pass a no-cap cap. So now we are to the decision, actually two decisions. The residents numbering in hundreds, more than the 600 that signed the bogus no SRT cap addition petition mentioned by Brian Duffy are finalizing a draft of an SRT cap referendum very similar to the one Scott Pierce has proposed. We are considering setting the SRT cap at the current level of 1775. Also, and this is a second decision, we, after all of this just inaction and bad listening, and I can see those of you already with your minds made up aren't going to change. I learned something a long time ago, and we all should know that by the time that we're here, and that is that any individual cannot change any mind but his or her. And so these continual talks by the residents aren't changing the minds of the five people that already have made up their minds for personal interest, confusion, whatever it is.
Mr. Smith.
But we're not getting through, so we're going to have to do the referendum and work on the next election to council. Thank you.
Next item is approval of previous meeting minutes. You've got Special City Council STR workshop on January 23rd, Special City Council executive session on January 24th, City Council January 24th, Special City Council STR workshop on February 6th, Special City Council workshop on February 13th. The committee meeting minutes are included just for your perusal. They will be edited or approved at the committee meeting, so we are approving items A through E.
Motion to approve.
Second. Any changes or edits? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Old business discussion of IOP connector alternatives. You've got included in your packet the piece you'd already seen from the SCDOT. Do you need anything from the Public Safety Committee you want to open with?
I think it is probably in the minutes, but the committee liked option five. I think it was like a 2-1 vote that we would recommend option five.
Three.
Blair, Jan, anything?
Yes, I do have.
Let me just real quick before you go there, Jan. So we, Jimmy and I had talked. The public comment period for the connector options closed on February 17th, I think it was. So we are expecting our traffic engineer as well as the SCDOT consultant that conducted that to come to our March meeting. That's why we just have this as a discussion item tonight, to come to our March meeting and talk about those findings from the online survey, as well as let our traffic engineer, you know, opine on anything that she sees. Jan's with, sorry.
Okay. I'd just like to voice my dissent with the decision of the Public Safety Committee. I prefer option five. There's been a lot of discussion in this community about how bad traffic is. And option five will both help improve traffic as well as maintain a safe roadway for our community. This is a chance that we have to make an improvement that probably will not come along for another 10 years. Traffic and safety are two sides of the same coin, and I am here to tell you that we can have it both ways with what's being proposed. For those of you who don't know me, I am a traffic engineer with 40 years worth of experience solving these kinds of issues for communities. So not only do I have our welfare at stake, but I also have ideas about how we can improve traffic. And the best option that we have is option 5. I'd like to tell you a couple of things that I've found out about some misconceptions about the connector in my analysis. First of all, the connector is one of the safest thoroughfares in the state, with fewer than 20 incidents a year, and only a handful, 4 or 5, actually have any kind of injury at all. It is probably the safest major principal arterial in the community, in the state. So when you talk about safety, count your blessings every time you drive across the connector, because anywhere else you go in your car, you're more likely to have an accident. Any fatalities that have come up in this discussion the center median did not affect the outcome, and they did not prevent fatalities. They were all because of other issues, and I can talk to you about those at another time. But there are two important factors in evaluating our alternatives. One is about emergency access, and the other is about traffic safety and control. I want to first say that all of the options proposed by SEDOT are safe for pedestrians, motorists, and bicyclists alike, but all entail some degree of risk, and safety is all about risk. However, there is one plan that is both safe and reduces traffic congestion more than the others, and that's my preferred option 5, with 2 lanes leaving the island. With traffic volumes increasing to over 20,000 vehicles per day for 4 or 5 months of the year, it's not just 1 or 2 weekends anymore, it's all the time. I know that we are approaching capacity on the connector, so one of my priorities is to increase capacity and avoid gridlock, which we have experienced on occasion already on the island. But we must do that safely. So I asked Fire Chief Olivarius if response times had increased since the center lane was removed. And he told me that there had been no significant difference. Then I asked Chief Cornett if his officers could manage a reversible lane on the bridge. And he said that we would need additional manpower for that. So it appears to me that the best way to improve traffic conditions safely is to add a second travel lane off of the island to improve the worst condition. It should be noted that the more congested a road is, the higher the accident rate. So by reducing congestion, we are increasing safety. We're not just making it more convenient for you, we're making it safer. By reducing travel times on the connector, we are also improving response times for emergency vehicles, especially for vehicles exiting the island on summer afternoons, where they can move faster. We are also investigating stationing an emergency vehicle on the island during peak periods, which would effectively cut response times in half, as we no longer have to wait for a vehicle to come from the mainland to our sick person on the island. Also, there have been questions about how this would function with the rest of the connector. This is the first phase of a multi-phase project. We have to decide what the configuration of this connector is. Then South Carolina DOT is already committed to reconfiguring the intersections at both ends of the connector so that if we have 2 lanes off, they would be carried all the way through to Highway 17. We'll also, a third part is retiming the signals all along the connector and making any other intersection changes that we find out are needed for that. That project is already funded and in the works. But the first step is figuring out what lane configuration we have so that we can do all of the intersection improvements that go with that configuration. So I'm just asking that we make a good decision that benefits all of us. It's safe, and we also improve traffic conditions on the island. Thank you for your time.
We've got both our chiefs. We've got both our chiefs here tonight, so we're going to ask them at some point to come up and talk. I know Rusty and then John and Blair and Jenna.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. I don't like this. The audio was terrible. I'm going to say that. Council member Anderson did a great job explaining all this. I mean, she went into a lot of detail. Not much to add there, and I certainly won't even attempt to do that. I know we're going to have more conversation on the different concepts. I honestly favor concept 5, which is 2 lanes off. But what I really wanted to do just briefly is remind everybody, this is just the first step. There's a lot of public opinion that have weighed in on this. This is not an Isle of Palms decision. At the end of the day, whatever we decide, it's subject to a lot of input from other municipalities, DOT, and, I think we can come up with a better solution at the end of the day, but there's a lot of work to be done. This is not something this Isle of Palms is going to take a vote. We're going to do whatever we recommend. It's not going to happen. Thank you. John?
Yeah, I also strongly support option 5, but my question is more around process. The DOT, as Councilman Streetman suggested, is the one that ultimately makes this decision. And I'm not sure the timing of the public comment period was over on February 17th. And we're not going to discuss this or take consideration until the end of March. Would that be too late in terms of a decision? I don't know the timeline, but we're sitting, over a month away before we even talk about it and then get... I don't want to make the same mistake we did with the infamous S-40 legislation when the governor was getting ready to sign the bill and didn't really understand how the council felt about that piece of legislation.
I think we need to go forward and make a resolution and send it to Secretary Hall and the DOT, letting them know how council feels about these decisions. And if the end of March is too late, I suggest we take action prior to that.
Yes. Desiree, you want to talk the process? I don't think it is too late, but if you want to talk to it.
Yes, and we understand that there are issues with the audio. Amy's doing what she can. We have some people trying to help remotely. We'll certainly make sure that this doesn't happen for the next meeting. So we all can just speak really loud. We're recording it in a different device, so we'll upload that at the end of the meeting for everybody to hear. But we sincerely apologize. We're equally shocked and embarrassed that this is happening. I guess now it works. As you all know, and the mayor said, the public comment period ended two weeks ago, mid-February. The consultant asked for a couple weeks to go over the results to also identify any duplicate IP addresses to ensure that there's not one person submitted multiple requests. So they're going through that. I anticipate having a meeting with them in the next week or two to go over the draft report of that survey, and then that will come before council at a follow-up date. But other than that, I don't have a definitive timeline on when a decision is going to be made. I suspect that they're going to go through the same process with Mount Pleasant as they did early on when they presented the 5 alternatives to their town council. So I anticipate the same process happening on both municipalities.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to speak briefly about why the Public Safety Committee is recommending Concept 3. And we did so with a caveat. We did not recommend Concept 3 by itself because as drawn by SEDOT, it does not meet their own safety requirements. None of them. The outside of the connector wall has to be higher or you're not supposed to have pedestrians or bicyclists on the connector. Period. And we're inviting people onto the connector under all of these concepts. So it has to be higher. That can be done with aluminum barring. not a big deal. The second is that there is no barrier between the pedestrians and bicyclists and traffic. You gotta have a barrier. Otherwise, if there is an issue, the pedestrians and cyclists are the ones trapped between a concrete wall and a vehicle. SCDOT has said that the connector could not handle a concrete barrier. There are metal barriers that are 60 pounds per foot that do everything SCDOT wants it to do. They just don't want to admit that, but those barriers exist. So what we suggest, what we voted on in public safety was concept three with the hard barrier and with the railing on the outside, because safety is more important than expediency. The reason we chose concept three is because our current fire chief likes emergency lane. Our former fire chief likes an emergency lane. Our current police chief likes an emergency lane. Our prior police chief likes an emergency lane. And Eric Watson, the deputy county administrator for Charleston County, in charge of all EMS, demands an emergency lane. So we relied on the professionals that are first responders that put their lives at risk when there is an issue on the connector and said, what do y'all want? An emergency lane. That's concept three. That's why we did that. Now, as to the issue of what DOT can and can't do by law, and they've already broken this law once by redoing the connector without our permission, but by law under South Carolina Statute 57-5-820, they have to have the consent of both the Isle of Palms and Mount Pleasant, or they can't do anything on the connector. So I would urge council to make sure that we bring that up with SCDOT and that we work with Mount Pleasant to come up with a plan that both municipalities agree on, and then instruct SCDOT on how to do that in a manner that is safe for everybody. Thank you, Mayor.
And then we'll hear from our public safety folks.
Just briefly, I like concept three based upon conversations we had with the fire and police chief. They like an emergency lane. We've always had an emergency lane since the connector opened in October 1993. I'm concerned, and I'm not a public safety expert by any means, but with two lanes going off the island and people being in a hurry, if it's not congested, won't there be a possibility of people passing cars, and it's just going to increase the speed on the connector and, in my mind, increase the possibility of accidents. Right now, the number one end result of an accident is rear-end collisions, what I understand. I think that would just greatly increase. I'm very much in favor, as Blair is, of an emergency lane. We've always had one. Thanks.
Katie?
Yes, I'd like to say that I'm in favor of version 5. And I think a lot of this idea that we have to have the safest road possible is it's a nice idea, but we could decrease the speed on Highway I-26 down to 15, and it would be a lot safer, but it would also take a lot longer to get places. There's a lot of four-lane roads out there. Yes, two-lane roads oftentimes are safer, especially if you have a large barrier in between, but again, you increase traffic a whole lot if you got rid of all the roads that are more than two lanes. I also think that this would be a nice thing that we might be able to be on the same side as Mount Pleasant, because I would certainly think that they would be thrilled to have two lanes going off this island. It's mostly the Mount Pleasant day trippers that are trying to leave at 4 o'clock or whenever the thunderstorm comes. So I think that having two lanes off would be wonderful for everybody. I do sometimes like to leave the island on the weekends. I try not to, but sometimes I have to.
Chief O or Oh, sorry, Kevin. Then let's hear from our public safety folks.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Last but least, I'm liking concept three as well. To repeat, Councilman Hahn, our police chief and our fire chief supported that. I'd like to have our emergency lane back. I'm not really opposed to concept five. I guess I'm afraid that with concept five, until Mount Pleasant or SCDOT does something on the Mount Pleasant side, we're just creating a pinch point at the end of the bridge and just stacking cars on the bridge until that road gets adjusted on the other side. But right now, I'm kind of pushing for concept three. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Somebody
should
clarify that.
Hang on. Scott.
I hope you can hear me. I'd like to weigh in as well. I think that concept five is the best option for the island as far as traffic congestion and neighborhood safety. Based on what I've been seeing and reading, we're going to add another 1,200 cars.
No.
Scott, you
can't hear you.
Chief O or Chief Cornett, what do y'all want to take the
no
the mic or the paperweight or whatever it is?
So running baton. Is there something specific you would like? I will say specifically, we can work with any of them that are up there. Obviously, if they put it there, we'll work around it. I will tell you where the comments are coming from. When we talked about option three, wasn't so much the emergency lane. It was the ability for me to maneuver vehicles around a collision. On a two-way out, obviously we can alleviate the traffic backed up on the island, which does clear Palm Boulevard, hopefully, clear Palm Boulevard and clear some of our secondary roads when that traffic builds up. But with that one, there's only one lane in. The concern I have with that would be if a collision came on the inbound lane, I have nowhere to redirect that traffic except for into the pedestrian and bike lane, or I have to send two additional police officers up there to direct traffic, because we got to stop one lane that's going outbound, and then we have to book somebody over there to direct the traffic coming inbound around the collision into that oncoming lane. That was my concern with it. Obviously, five does get traffic off of the island, and it does alleviate the traffic problem. The concern, again, would be the collision coming in. Option three does have its concern, because we cannot reverse that lane every weekend. I'd love to be able to say I could, but that would be something that took a lot of pre-planning with our partners at Highway Patrol or Mount Pleasant. It would be something on those really busy days, like 4th of July, maybe we could, depending on whether they're able to give us personnel or not. So that was kind of where we were with those two decisions and why we put those favors on there. Traffic or the emergency response time has not suffered as a result of the way it is painted now. But that was, I don't think it would, no matter what they do. I think the emergency access is going to be just as good as it is now, if not better, as the county's made maneuvers to put EMS and other vehicles in a position where they can respond fast no matter what. So that was ours. Are there any specific questions I can answer with that? Or clarify further?
I have a question or comment. I know that the old Pearlman Bridge, there was three lanes, if you remember, and as long as I've lived here, until it closed down, it had reversible lanes, but the lanes never reversed. It must not have been a good plan for South Carolina Department of Transportation.
DOT is not a fan of reversible lanes, especially on a bridge like this, because of the infrastructure that they see. When they're looking at it, they want to see those reversible lanes like you see on the interstate when you get into Georgia or these other states where they've kind of got barriers up and they've got lights above that tell you when it's open and when it's not. And that's a lot of infrastructure to put on the bridge to do a reversible lane. What we would be doing would be a quick, that's not as safe if we did a reversible lane down the middle as what they would do with their infrastructure.
But it's not something you would recommend doing every weekend?
Definitely not, no, right, sir. Chief Oliveris.
Yeah, Chief Oliveris.
Thank you for asking for our input. We can make any of those concepts work, one through five.
Chief Cornett and I have spoken about this, you know, at length and over the last few months. So depending on the will of the council and Mount Pleasant and what the community, you know, their input, we can make all of those concepts work. From a fire department perspective, again, you know, we went back to the data and to Ms. Anderson's point. The data did not show that there have been adverse effects to response times. To Councilman Hahn and Councilman Ward's point, we do prefer a safe connector. Like we all do that. We prefer to move traffic. Historically, when there was a larger center median, that was helpful in the past. So that's a good thing. But all five of those designs have their merits where they have a little bit better than the other one. So from a fire department perspective, when we get to an accident, we are very simplistic in our view. We want to keep our firefighters safe. We want to deal with that patient and mitigate whatever hazard it is. So for us, our preference is to shut down the entire roadway, do our work, clear up as quickly as we can, and let's get traffic moving, and we leave that in the hands of the professionals in you know, our police department to manage the traffic. But for us, the roadway is always a very dangerous place, and you speak to most firefighters, and they will tell you that when you go on an emergency call, you would rather it be off the roadway for whatever reason that is, and those reasons are, you know, the public, they're in a hurry, they might be distracted driving. It's a very dangerous place. So for us, we prefer to shut down that entire roadway, do our work quickly and efficiently, deal with the hazard, mitigate it, and then get out of there quickly, because we do not want secondary collisions to occur or traffic to back up where it impacts quality of life or safety. But for us, the big takeaway, we can make all those designs work. They all have their merits, and all of you have spoken about that, you know, very eloquently and laid out those points.
Yep. I don't know if you're the right one to answer this one, but with option five, can you move cars into the pedestrian bike lane? If you have an accident and you have two cars that have hit each other and, you know, they're both operable and everything else, obviously, can we move those cars into the pedestrian bike lane?
So Chief Cornett could answer that better than I could. But, you know, for us, you know, motorists are taught to pull to the right, and we're taught.
Hey, folks, can we cut the chatter just so we can hear? Thank you.
We teach our driver operators when they're driving in emergency status that, you know, all those drivers, we, the public, or we pull slowly to the right so the fire department or emergency vehicles can move over to the left. Chief Cornett could speak more to the point than I could about where those vehicles, if they're drivable, what the strategy would be there to make it safe and efficient.
If the vehicles are operable, then we could move them over there. If they're not operable, we could move traffic around it. The downside of that is you're now putting vehicles into your bicycle and pedestrian lane. And you've only got, with most of these, you've only got one side that has bicycle and pedestrian lanes. So we still got to shut that down for their safety. But yes, we could. And if they're operable, ultimately what we're going to do is get them off the bridge, and then we'll work it in a parking lot. That's the easiest way and the safest for us.
John, I'd just like to thank both chiefs. I think you've somewhat been placed in a little difficult position here, especially at the council, at the committee meeting, some of the questioning in here. So I thank you both for your professionalism in answering the questions.
And I think, John, to your question about timing, I think it's probably going to be second week of March before we even get the report from the SCDOT consultant. So I really do not, based on conversations so far, and I know we want our traffic engineer that we have on retainer to weigh in on this as well. So I think if we have them both here at our March meeting, I think we're fine time-wise.
Would it be worthwhile to talk to the Secretary Hall and just to make sure that she knows that we're going to be coming forth with a resolution from council on what we feel before they make a decision? Yeah. I just hate for them to make a decision and then without our input.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I don't know if we've had that conversation yet, but I'm sure she's fully expecting it. But, yeah,
and I'll communicate that to Secretary Hall.
And I think, Kevin, to your point, you know, if you wound up with option five, you know, you wouldn't do that without right without the other side of the bridge having the additional lane as well, so that they go hand in hand. Jan, I
would have to.
In fact, Mount Pleasant already has a plan on the books to four lane their end of the connector, at least to the shopping center. So it's just going to extend the whole way through. Uh-huh. It's part of the project.
Does there anything else? All right, thank you. More to come on that topic. Item B, discussion of proposed changes to the noise ordinance. You've got a proposed ordinance in your packet. Desiree or Douglas, if you want to provide update.
Yeah, so this is the first time full council sees a copy of the version that we've been talking and working through with the Public Safety Committee for the past, I would say, maybe 6 months. A lot of back and forth, a lot of different iterations have been presented to the committee. We've been asking feedback, incorporating that. This version has been reviewed by our legal counsel, and I'm sure there will be more questions today. And I know I think it has an additional round to go through public safety before it goes before council as a form of an ordinance for first reading. So the first thing that I wanted to highlight of the difference between this ordinance and what we have in the books is that this one would include some decibel thresholds, maximum decibel thresholds, depending on an area around the island. Right now, it's very subjective when it's very subjective when a noise is loud. It's up to the officer to determine based on a number of factors to determine whether the noise exceeds the requirements of the code. So this would facilitate enforcement, be very clear for our officers to determine when a noise exceeds a certain decibel reading, whatever number we end up deciding including in the ordinance, and a violation would occur, a citation could be issued, and corrective action could follow. Much easier to enforce, more objective for our officers to address. Right now, the way that we have includes, there are three different different maximum or decibel maximums depending on the area. On page 3 of the draft that you have included in your packet, subsection C includes those. Again, those are numbers that we put in based on other ordinances, example of ordinances in different municipalities, big cities, small communities, coastal communities, and so on. Right now, the decibel limit during daytime hours, which are the same daytime hours that we have included in the ordinance today, which is 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday. For residential and rental properties, that maximum would be 60 decibels. In commercial establishments, the maximum would be 70. Around the same time, those same hours, daytime hours.
Is it 70 or 75?
70.
That's right. Bill, can you clarify something on that?
Sure.
It was the commercial establishments, but the reading, if a commercial establishment is next to a residential, the reading is taken from the residential, and then residential how does that work?
The reading would be taken from the complainant's property. So if the noise is emanating from a commercial operation, the decibel maximum that would apply would be 70, in this case, based on this draft. But the reading would be taken from anywhere within the complainant's property. The original version that we had the reading being taken at the property line. There were concerns about elevated structures, elevated porches and whatnot, and the noise traveling. So we changed it and included that a reading by an officer could be taken anywhere along the property of the complainant.
So that is determined by where the noise originates?
Correct. The threshold would be from where the noise would originate. That's correct.
Desiree, can you speak to, or somebody on the Public Safety Committee, because I know y'all spent a lot of time on this, the decibel numbers? Have we modeled after somebody or recommendation that the 60, 70, 55 numbers?
We've looked at a lot of different communities, and I mean, quite frankly, me personally, I don't know what the right number is. And I think we're going to have to just pick some numbers and try it on for size, and 6 months later come in and see if that's the right number or not. It might not be. Might be it's too high, might be it's too low. Mr. Krause has been very passionate in his plea for the numbers to be lower. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know the answer right now.
Well, I think that we have like two very different and unique situations geographically. We have the Front Beach commercial area, which has been commercial forever, since, you know, 60 years, 70 years, more than that. And then we have the Sweetgrass Inn, which is right next to a residential area. I mean, right next to a residential area. The Windjammer, the properties across the street from the Windjammer, and the 1000 block of Carolina, all that property was zoned commercial. And so when the people came in and started building those houses, they knew they were building in a commercial area. The people on 56, 57 Grand Pavilion, when they came in and bought their houses, they didn't expect to be overwhelmed by a commercial establishment 7 days a week. I think it's very important that we have a three-legged stool here, but there's only like two of the parties that have ever been able to meet together, and that's the Sweetgrass Inn, the city, and the residents that are most affected by what's going on up there. It's a completely different situation. We might have to look at different zones, two different zones and two different decibel levels. I've learned a lot so far in the process. I have so much more to learn. Going from 60 to 70 is not just 10, it's like 10 times louder. And I've been up there. I don't know how many of the council members have been up there. We have made some strides in that they used to have 360-degree speakers right on the property line of the Sweetgrass Inn, and the music was going straight into the neighborhoods there. We are dealing with people's property values, and some people are rethinking whether they should buy in there. I know of at least one case. It really needs to have a real firm look, and I don't know how long the process is going to take, but I would encourage the city to ask for a meeting with the residents and also with the officials from the Sweetgrass Inn. I don't want to change anything about what's going on in the Front Beach area. It's fine, and it doesn't seem like that needs any adjustment. But I do think it's important that we do realize that we're talking about two different zones here.
Jim.
All right. The Public Safety Committee looked at the noise ordinances from a number of different cities. The ones in South Carolina, our neighbors, have not had as much measurement in their ordinances, which makes them hard to enforce. But other larger cities in particular have done a lot more research in determining what levels are best for the different kinds of land uses, and I'd like to emphasize use rather than zoning or anything like that. In addition, there were some decibel scales that we've used that show different noise levels, and two of them here that are similar, if you want to look at those. What we learned is that the majority of municipalities set a noise level for residential areas of 60 decibels during the day and 55 decibels at night. I think I've got something that I haven't shared with the Public Safety Committee yet, but I found a, thanks to one of our community members, a summary of more than 400 municipalities and what they use as their measurements. And generally, 60 decibels is what is used in residential areas for the day and 55 at night. So that's pretty common. In commercial areas, it can vary. 75 decibels, I thought, was the number that the Public Safety Committee had come up with. So I may be wrong about that, but that's what mine shows. Is loud, but it's not inordinately loud. And if you look at the noise measurement levels, it usually says that the sounds above 85 decibels are harmful. Now, that's sort of the level that we decided that would be good for the windjammer, because as Jimmy mentioned, windjammer's been there before any residences were built around them. So it's a loud level. It allows them to do their business as usual. Anyone who has a home near there would have bought knowing that this was their next-door neighbor, so that we thought that would be reasonable for there. I think there's been a suggestion also that, in terms of enforcement, that it might just be easier to use that as an exception with a commercial use in general for the island, to have a 75 decibel level for generally for commercial areas, with an exception for the Front Beach GC1's area for us. It's based on a lot of information from other cities that I believe Councilmember Hahn has reviewed with me when on the Public Safety Committee. Councilmember Ward is a newer member, so I apologize if you haven't seen all of this information.
Newer member?
This year.
So I think we've done a lot of work on this, and it appears that we're working towards something that is enforceable, that's comparable to other areas. The one issue that I think we still have is one with the Wild Dunes Resort, and just coming up with a way that possibly they have approached us and said they do have some large conferences that they have that they admit have loud noise, and would like to be able to do that only on certain occasions, and possibly there's a way that we could work out a permitting operation for that, where we are in control of allowing them this so that they can be as productive as they can, but if they abuse it, then we can pull it back. So I think that's a give and take for that.
Mr. Mayor,
did you say 75?
75 for commercial areas.
One final comment.
I'm just wondering, because this says 70. I'm just wondering if I'm looking at it right.
We've gone through multiple iterations. We can go back and see what the actual I don't think the committee has actually recommended a number. So we've gone through back and forth what a reasonable limit would be for resident commercially used properties.
Can we follow up on my request for a meeting with Wild Dunes or Sweetgrass Inn and the residents?
Together?
Yes.
We've met? Yes. Oh.
We do that?
With council?
Well, with the public, start with Public Safety Committee.
Public Safety.
Sure, we can provide that.
And last point is, if you haven't been there when these parties are going on, I invite you to go up there and answer me truthfully if that's where you would like to live.
Yeah. So, Desiree, you want to keep walking through any changes or that kind of?
Yes, I'll just go through some of the highlights. Councilmember Anderson spoke about an additional exception for GC2. That's the commercial area on Front Beach between 10th and 14th Avenue, both sides of Ocean in that section. They would have a maximum threshold of 85 decibels only during daytime hours. During nighttime hours, everybody has to comply with a maximum of 55. If you look at some of the charts that we've included in the packet, 60 is equal to 60 decibels. It's equal to a normal conversation. I'm sure I'm exceeding that now because I'm trying to speak really loud. But that's just so that you have an idea of what a comparable noise is by those different decibels. So that's what's included in this draft is having an 85 maximum threshold for GC2. The other thing we added to this draft is the ability of any property owner or commercial establishment to come before City Council and request an exemption for a particular event. That's on page 6, section 6. So properties such as Wild Dunes or any other commercial property can come to City Council and say, hey, we have a special event. We think we're going to exceed the maximum. We would like approval, and it would be up to City Council to grant that or reject that as you all please. This is very similar to the process that we follow for city-sponsored event, that those requests come before you all. The other thing I wanted to highlight is the permit process for an exemption. Right now we have it that approval would be limited to no more than 15 hours in 1 year. That's something that could change if that's the will of council. But at no time, even if they receive an exemption from City Council, it cannot exceed 85. So 85 would be the maximum that a property would be able to get granted or get approval for. Then also wanted to make sure you look at the section for violations. You all know we are limited into the amount of a municipal summons to $500. A $500 fine essentially doubles once court assessments are included. So a fine can go up to about $1,097. So if we issue the maximum violation, that's what a property owner, so whoever's in violation of the ordinance would have to pay. We've also included that in addition to those penalties by when found in violation of exceeding the threshold or any of the other sections in the ordinance, 5 repeated violations could result in the revocation of a business license. So that is something that's included in subsection J. Wanted to alert you to that. Those are really the highlights that I wanted to make sure you all looked at. We're going to go back to public safety. We can certainly request, to Councilmember Ward's point, that residents and members of the Sweetgrass Inn attend that meeting. I think they're interested in doing that.
Who's interested? Sweetgrass?
I think both. I think both parties would appreciate it.
I know the residents are.
Yes, and I understand it.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Do we need an exception for the 4th of July for fireworks?
There is an exception included for city sponsored and city events,
but
city public
events. I don't know how loud. I feel like fireworks could be more than 85. We saw that absolute 85 threshold. I just don't want our fireworks show to get shut down.
not the way it's written right now. It doesn't look like an exception. A city sponsored.
Any city sponsored.
But we don't. So the 85 is only for
commercial and individual property owners. Yes.
Rusty?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I was just going to say that we've been talking about this for a while. And for me, I mean, the front beach is a layup. I mean, it's going to be noisy down there. It's where people go to have fun. They go to have fun. They know it's going to be noisy. You choose to live down there, buy something down there, a condo or whatever, you know that it's going to be noisy. So that's an easy layup there. The problematic areas are certainly what is going on at down near the Sweetgrass Inn. That is one we've got to effectively address. But I've heard very little conversation tonight about just the neighborhoods themselves, you know, and, you know, establishing a decibel level that everybody can feel good about, but also have something that's enforceable. We've heard Chief Cornett
many times, hey, it's working. Chief Cornett say that, you know, give us a number. We can enforce something that's there, that we know what the decibel level is. And I guess my challenge for all of council, and I know we're going back to committee,
we're going to have other meetings, but we need to arrive at some sort of number, to council member Hahn's point, that we put in place and see how it works. If it needs to be tweaked at some point, we should be able to do that down the road. So that's where I'm at.
And my recommendation would be, once we get a draft finalized, that the city council enacts something for a short period of time, maybe 6 months, 9 months, to allow us to see how it works and then be able to come back with some recommendations and adjustments based on what we're seeing on the field.
Yeah, I just really appreciate that meeting as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
maybe at the next public safety committee meeting. Yes. Desiree, when is that? Is that meeting the 7th or the 9th?
Yes, sir. It's Tuesday, March 7th at 10 a.m.
Yeah, because I couldn't find it on the calendar. Somebody else asked me. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What else, Desiree?
That's all I have.
Council, any other questions, comments? Thank you. Item C, discussion and consideration of alternatives for regulating short-term rentals. You know, we've been discussing this for months, had listing sessions, workshops. We've got alternatives in the packet down to 5 that we'll discuss tonight and have some conversation with. So, Doug, if you want to walk us through the 5 options that are in the proposal.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I will, so there's, we're saying there's 5. I would say there's actually 6. We have a 1 and a 1A. So these are all alternatives that the staff has developed. With some of them are our own, some of them at the request of council members. All of these are based on Charleston County property tax record numbers for dwelling units. So if there's a statistic there or a number there that indicates dwelling units, that's taken from the Charleston County tax records. And then also we're using the short-term rental issued short-term rental licenses for any indication of whether or not it's licensed or not. So we're using both the county data and the city's licensing data to build these alternatives.
The first alternative is specific. It would be a 6% cap. So this is non-owner-occupied properties that are single-family residences only. So this excludes things like condominiums, townhouses, things of that nature. So that generates a denominator for that alternative of 3,114. And we have kind of taken a few guesses at what a cap there might be. We've run the numbers with 35%, 33%, 30%, and 25%. That generates, depending on which percentage you all were to choose, that would generate a different number, obviously, for the cap or for the maximum number that would fit under that cap. And then we've done the analysis of if you look at the number of 6% single family dwellings that currently have a license, that number is 723. So there is what we call headroom. Under each of those scenarios, going from little headroom with a 25% cap of 56 to a fairly sizable headroom of 367 for the 35% cap. So alternative, what we've labeled as alternative 1A, is the same concept, but instead of just single family residences, we've run this across all dwelling units. So that increases the denominator to 4,570 units, and this would now include things like condominiums, townhouses. So this would be all dwelling units. And again, we've run those numbers with what it would look like with a 35, 33, 30, and 25% cap. When you look at that class of property, and you look at 6%. Properties within that class, the number there of currently issued license is 1,570. So significantly higher number of properties with a license in that class. And then if you look at what's available there, the only one that has any headroom would be if you establish the cap at 35% of that pool, that would still have 30 properties or 30 licenses available. The other three categories have a deficit, so we'd already be over the cap if you were to enact either 33, 30, or 25. So I would take a pause there. The next two are also kind of related. So any questions on 1 or 1A at this point?
One question. 1A, does that include hotel rooms with the denominator?
No, it does not.
Jan?
On alternative one?
Yes.
There are, 1,456 dwelling units that are not included in alternative one that are included in 1A. Those are assumed not to have a cap. So you have to add 1,500 units to the number of short-term rental licenses that would be available under alternative one to make these two comparable.
Well, so in the 6% under the currently issued line, that's only currently issued out of the pool of single-family residences. That's the reason that's 723. It's only taken from.
Okay. But of the total units on the island that would be eligible for short-term rentals,
the total dwelling unit
that you've taken out are all multifamily units.
Well, it's like 700.
And alternative one is just single-family.
Correct. Alternative 1A includes everything, all dwellings.
So 1A has 1,500 more units included as the total. In 1, you've taken out 1,500 units that would be eligible for short-term rental licenses.
That's correct.
I think this is where it gets to the whole, what is the island cap? Because we're presenting an island cap of 35% in 1A, but alternative 1 is 54%. And it doesn't show up that way. This is where we need to really take into consideration what is the island impact of each one of these alternatives. It's an apple and an orange here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You can't compare 1 and 1A at all because 1, alternative 1, does not include 1,500 dwelling units.
Correct. Yeah, they're two very distinctly different.
We're not comparing 1 and 1A.
They're two very different scenarios.
Two different options.
Okay. I understand that, but what you're presenting on here is that the cap is 35% in alternate 1A. That's not the same 35% in number one. They're being called the same thing, but they're very different because of the exclusion of all the dwelling units.
That's very correct. The first one has just single family residences. The second one has every dwelling unit. So they are very different pools.
Right. In alternative one, the 33% column there is a 54% cap on the island. The 33% in alternative 1A is a 33% cap. I think we've got to really, line these things up side by side.
Well, but I think there's a fundamental difference in what needs to be capped. Are we trying to cap everything on the island? I know, Scott, that's what you want to do. Or do we want to only cap single family residents? And that's, so, I mean, I don't understand what you're saying with this 54. I've never seen a 54% number. The number is capping single-family dwellings and the percentage of single-family dwellings that have a short-term rental license.
Right, but we've got another 1,456 uncapped dwellings.
Of course we do, because those are the condominiums and the townhouses that are primarily built for short-term rentals.
But it equals a 54% cap island-wide. You need to do the math. It's very simple math. Very simple math.
I understand the math, but I think it's misleading to say that it's at a 54% level. That's not accurate.
It is. No, that is the cap. That would be the island-wide cap, 54%.
I think the most effective thing to do would be say what percent. Typically, when we talk of percents, it means the percentage of blank. So you have to fill in that blank in order to make this make sense. You can't just say 33%, 40%, 100% of what. You have to define the pie. And if the pie changes, the percentage changes. So the first one is, 35% of single family. If that's what you want, that is understanding that the multi-family dwelling units are not part of that percentage. They are, so it's the equation is 35% of single family plus 100%, if possible, of multi-family. So that's your, if you really want to get down to the math of this, that's your equation for one. And your equation for two, or 1A, sorry, would be 35% of all dwellings. So I think that's, I think if we just use a few more words and make the equation actually mathematically right, we could probably all be talking about the same thing.
Yeah, so that is exactly what it is. And so I think what you and Councilman Pierce are saying is that on option one, if you do your math that you're talking about, the island-wide percent saturation of short-term rentals could reach 54%. Not, it wouldn't be
33 or 35%. It would be ultimately 54%. Potentially, assuming that every townhouse and every condominium had a short-term rental lockup.
And I also disagree with the presumption, though, that the condos were built for short-term rentals. I think it was earlier, there's some information
on history that was provided to us in our
council email that suggests that these weren't the case. These are condominiums that were built. We have lots of residents that live in these condominiums now. We have lots of, they were built for retirees and second homes. And I don't think anybody envisioned when those condos were built
that they were going to be built for the sole purpose of short-term rentals. I think that's not correct. And secondly, the problem that I have with this is that regardless, we represent all island residents. To suggest that we're going to exclude part of those, I think, is it because these short-term rentals don't impact just those people that live in the condos. They impact the whole island. And so we have to take into consideration who we represent and not start to carve up and carve out for various and sundry reasons. I think it's a mistake on our part to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I will, for the sake of clarity, I will try to counsel person Meyer's point, identify the denominator in each of these, because she is correct. Every scenario is kind of excluding, well, there are some scenarios that are every dwelling unit, but most of them exclude some part of the population or some part of the housing stock. Alternative 1A excludes all condos. These next two, and I'll just continue down the list in the packet, these next two are going to exclude everything. They're going to exclude everything in the commercial district. So the next two, the pool and the denominator, as I would call it, is now a slightly different number. It's 4190, and so that number is every dwelling unit. So that would include condos, single family houses, townhouses, everything outside of the commercial district.
Front Beach commercial district.
Yes, the Front Beach commercial district. So that denominator is 4190. The proposed cap that we've talked about and kind of over time we have discussed 33% being a key amount. So this alternative sets the cap at 33% of 4190, which yields a cap number or maximum number of rental units at 1,383. If you look at the number of licenses currently issued for that area outside of the commercial district, that is 1,467. So this alternative has a deficit of 84 units. So we're already a bit, what I would call a bit over that cap. Any questions about denominator or percentage or what pool we're pulling from on that one? The next one's going to be similar.
I will. Let me just say this for clarity. Alternative 2 makes no distinction between properties that are 4% and those that are at 6%. That distinction will show in Alternative 3. But that's the main difference between Alternative 2 and 3 is that you're just taking all dwelling units outside of the commercial district and limiting short-term rental licenses, regardless whether they're issued to a property that is at a 4% tax rate or a 6% tax rate.
And can I just add one
Yeah, I want to just add one thing here, that the exclusion here, instead of being 1,450 properties, is about 380. And to be an apple to apple, the total cap rate for the entire island is not 33% on alternative three. It's 39% because of the exclusion. Same would apply to what we had before. So again, I think in each one of these, we need to evaluate and make sure that everybody knows what the island wide impact is going to be.
So you're just saying add back in, it's the plus 80 for Front Beach.
But to be clear, you're assuming all of those will have a short-term rental license, so it's misleading.
Blair, to counter that or to respond, it's already at 81%, so it's not...
What's at 81%, Scott?
The Front Beach saturation.
The number of licenses of those 300 and so that are issued,
and also
is 81% of 300.
We're discussing a cap, a maximum.
Yeah.
So if that is what we're talking about, and there is no cap on certain ones, then that means that the maximum is 100%. I mean, that's not misleading. That's math.
All right. We ready for alternative three? I'm sorry. Alternative three. So this is the same pool of properties. It's the same 4,190 properties. It's every dwelling unit, excluding the commercial district. And under this alternative, the cap would be set at also 33%, so that would yield a maximum number of 1,383 licenses available out of that pool of properties. And under this proposal, the cap would only apply to 6% dwelling units. So owner-occupied properties would be exempt. And if you analyze the number of licenses that are in that pool of properties, that number is currently at 1,270. So this one would have, again, what we call a little bit of headroom at 113 units or licenses available under that scenario. It's alternative three. Any questions about that one? Next one is alternative four in your packet, and this one is from the Planning Commission, and you will recall that their recommendation is now probably about a year old, and at that time they were using about year-old data. So when they did their recommendation, it's now based on two-year-old data. So what we've tried to do is count and account for all of the zones. So their recommendation was based on creating different zones across the island, and then having what they had was an exempted zone, which was basically the oceanfront. It was all condos, all oceanfront properties, and exempted that section of the island, and then applied caps in the other remaining three zones. They carved it into three areas. And their recommendation was for a cap to be established at a number that is 10% higher than the current number of licenses. So we haven't done that math here on in your packet, but their proposal would have established a cap. If you look at the total STRL column, their proposal would be to establish a cap at 10%, a number 10% higher than those numbers, excluding Zone 4, which their recommendation was to exempt Zone 4. So we haven't done that full analysis. There's a second page that we could get into, but I think if you were to go back to the Planning Commission recommendation, we would need to do some work and just probably go back to the Planning Commission
talking about what their intent is. it is apples and oranges, right? Because
yeah,
of the fact that the 25% will well blown past any of those numbers at this point.
Yeah, well, so the Planning Commission used a methodology to identify the zones that they wanted to identify, that they wanted the cap to apply to, and to Councilmember Bogosian's point, their threshold at the time was they saw some very high areas and they saw some very low areas. They kind of arbitrarily drew a line in the sand at 25%. The point's been made that now two of those districts are, one is at 25 and one's at 32. When they did their analysis, those two were under 25%. I think their logic would still be to apply a cap to zone 1 and 2 and not say, oh, well, because they're now above 25%, we don't think there should be a cap. But, again, I think that would be for them to say, not really me to say. But the 25% was really just a methodology of how to arrange the zones. It was not to say, if you ever get above 25%, then remove the cap or take the cap
away. Well, I think also part of it was the fact that that there was already highly dense areas of short-term rentals on the oceanfront and the condos and some other areas. But the residential area of, for example, between 21st and 41st, which was one zone, was at 12% back when they were doing this, and now it's above 25%. Wow. So, that was their whole concern back at that point, was that there's been a migration of short-term rentals into the historically residential areas, and, now they're going past any of those percentages that they were considering at that time. So it's very hard. Yeah, they're also considering capping at 10% 2020 levels, which also makes it very difficult at this point, because you're going, you're in a deficit. So it's very hard to compare what they were analyzing, even as short as a year ago at this point. I mean, we'd almost have to redo that, I think, in its entirety to make any kind of reasonable plan at this point.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you could apply their logic of going 10% above zone 1, 2, and 3's current numbers. You could apply that logic, but I would agree that if you were to want to pursue that plan, I think you'd probably want that to go back to the Planning Commission.
Let me just add, I think the implications there, though, look at zone 3. If you were to say 10% above the current levels, you'd be at 260 licenses.
Right.
Roughly. And what you look at zone 3 when they did the plan, that number was 152. So what you're assuming that we're going to add another 100 plus licenses just at will here because of the growth that's already occurred. I think the Planning Commission's plan, and to steal a phrase from Tom Schmidt, it was a great idea, but time was its worst enemy here. And it is completely obsolete in my mind. These numbers have been blown past what the initial Planning Commission's thresholds were, and for us to take 10% above where we are now would be several hundred above where they anticipated it to be. And the whole bit about having a threshold above the 25%, all of their thresholds were set to avoid getting to a 25%. So once again, I think we're, we've got an obsolete plan here, unfortunately.
Well, if you were to look at the Wild Dunes Zone 3 that is being referenced, that number today is at 232 licenses. So 10% right. of that would be 23 additional licenses in Wild Dunes. That would get their zone to 24%.
Right. So take a look at what they had in the plan. I'm looking at page 19 of your presentation. They had 152. 10%
right.
above that is 167. What they would, if you apply that to today, they have to reel back 65 licenses.
Right.
That's right.
We're making up numbers here. 10% above the existing thing.
Just for the record, we are handing out the one of the pages that was included in the packet that shows the breakdown of zone of the of alternative 4, which assumes the Planning Commission's model. Just updating the numbers. There's no assumptions on a cap there. It's just an updated number of where we are today compared to where Planning Commission's numbers were in 2020.
Which was what was in our packet.
Correct. It's you all have everything in your packet. We're just, yeah. I just want to clarify for you all to know what you're getting.
And I would just finish up by saying the last alternative on your list here is alternative 5, which is the no cap option of continuing enforcement efforts, monitor trends, metrics, at least semi-annually. So that's the list of alternatives. We, you know, like I said, have taken what was posed to us and tried to get that data out for you and present it back to you. I'm happy to answer questions about it.
Thanks. Douglas, real quick before we leave, alternative 4, you know, whether we have the Planning Commission revisit or not, it's more about the concept of zones and applying caps and such, right?
I mean, yeah, their primary objective, and Councilman Pierce talked about it, was to basically lock in different areas close to their current levels. They felt like there was a mass migration kind of around the island, across the island, and they wanted to lock those percentages pretty much close to what they were at the time. The point's definitely been made that we have a lot more licenses today than we did then, but I think that logic of kind of locking different neighborhoods in at different densities probably still holds the same water for the Planning Commission that it did at that time. But again, I think that would be for them to say and not me.
But do we know how many short-term rental licenses were taken out, basically? Since this Planning Commission numbers came out, there was definitely a spike that people went out and defensively bought short-term rental licenses. We've heard that over and over also. So we don't really know how many of these additional licenses are truly short-term rental versus just having a license?
Yeah, we've never truly been able to vet that out. I mean, we have indications of whether or not they're 6% or 4%. That helps us. There was a declared revenue amount that kind of helped. We have indicators, but we cannot get that down to a perfect number of exactly how many are truly not took out a license and truly not rented. Just can't get there.
But we do know how many permanent residents took out short-term rental licenses.
4% properties, correct.
Yeah, and you can see that on the second page. Well, we have it broken down by zone. Zone 1, which is breach inlet to the IOP connector, you can see under the first column, 4%. 30 have a short-term rental license. 34% property owners in that zone have short-term rental licenses. Okay. That went up. In total, in that zone, it went up 63%.
Okay. Since, well, all I want to establish is the fact that we have a few hundred permanent residents with short-term rental licenses of the, what is it now, 1,700 that are issued.
The majority, 202
of the 1,700. The overwhelming majority of the short-term rental licenses are held by non-residents. Okay, that we know for sure. And the point is that there aren't a lot of people who live on this island that went out and bought short-term rental licenses when we started discussing it. There are a few. The people who've been buying the short-term rental licenses for the last year after we started talking are non-residents. Now, they may be second homeowners, but they are not permanent residents here.
And they may have no desire to rent it at all. They're just doing it defensively.
That's still a point, but they're the non-residents we're talking about. We're not talking about our residents.
Or vice versa.
Right. We don't know.
Staff, thank you all for doing a lot of work. Go ahead.
No, that's all we have. I think this sheet, which includes the different distribution by type of property, by zone, even if you want to ignore the zone concept, that does give you a lot of information of where the licenses are located and in what kind of property.
The only other thing that we have is a list, and we may want to save this till after your discussion on the alternatives, but we do have kind of a laundry list of what we think we could, areas we could improve from a staffing standpoint and an administrative standpoint. This would change, I think, our list would change if we were to implement a cap and meet that cap. I think that would add some, add some administrative needs. But we have that list, and I don't know if we want to go over that now or after.
Yeah, let's hold that for just a second. And that's in our packet, other things to consider.
Correct.
That you guys have come back with, which is what we ask you to do. So, other questions?
I was just going to make a suggestion sooner rather than later. I've been wanting to talk to legal counsel about this issue for various different reasons, pretty much since we started talking about this. I'm just wondering if now would be a time to do that, or if we want to have some discussion and then talk or go to an executive session. I'm up for either. I just want to make sure that we get that part taken care of.
That's a really good idea, but I think that if we go into executive session, it needs to be stated on current agenda.
On current agenda.
Which it is.
I don't know if Councilman Pierce has audio or not, but he put together did make it into the packet, but a comparison of all these options. And I think that would be valuable to just go through. It's a pretty brief comparison. But I don't know if he can talk or if that's audio. Apparently,
yeah, it's not
in the packet.
He can hear us. We can't hear him. Do you want me to go through this, Sharon?
I would like to pass. Yeah, hand it out, Desiree.
Desiree, it's not in the packet. How do we go down this path?
You can still. I mean, it's not in the official packet, but...
It can be posted online.
Mr. Mayor, I would like to have it passed out and discuss it. It does show, actually, it was brought up and raised on the February 6th meeting in the packet. We had a friendly amendment to show the island-wide impact of all of these. That was accepted. I would like to have this passed out.
Could
we
have...
Yeah, it'd just be like you bring something
else to the meeting. Was that the friendly amendment on the motion we never passed because it was suggested on there?
Yes, there's a...
Legal counsel, whether it's appropriate.
I just asked and he nodded his head that it would be okay. So
it's a demonstrative aid, and as long as we call it what it is, it's not based on that. It's just a demonstrative aid.
Yeah, if my work's there, I'm happy to represent it as my work. I just think that we need to take a look and get it disclosed. It's very easy, simple math, and it's something that we talked about doing a side-by-side. We have not seen one side-by-side view of the total island-wide impact. We agreed that we were going to do this 3 weeks ago.
This is making a very large assumption, for example, in the first no-cap arena, everything's got a... short-term rental license on it.
That's what 100% means. If you don't have, but we're talking about a cap, that means putting a lid, a limit. Maybe we should change the name to limit instead of cap. We are talking about potentially putting a limit on the number of short-term rentals. If we say that the limit is 100% of residents, then that means, theoretically, this is not tomorrow. This is a theoretical conversation. That means that, theoretically, 100% of the residents could become short-term rentals. No one's saying that's going to happen. That is what the math is. If the limit is 100%, the potential is 100%.
My only point with that is that the assumption is everybody's got a short-term rental license. You can also assume that nobody will.
Exactly.
And the trend over the last 12 years has been going down and not up. And if we're trying to do facts, that's the truth.
Hey,
I'm just
folks, listen, we're having conversations here.
Thank you, Mayor. But if we're going to talk about factual issues, let's talk facts. And let's not say, well, the fantasy is that every unit on the island would be a short-term rental.
because that's not realistic. It's not realistic that there'll never be any short-term rentals on the island. Of course not. But let's talk about the facts, and let's talk about the trends that we have over the last 12 years.
Hey, Blair, will it be okay since I prepared this to represent what it actually says instead of what you're...
I'm happy for you to discuss this. My point is, it's a demonstrative aid. It is not based in fact. And I think it's inappropriate to put it out that way because it drives fear. It drives fear within the community. And I think it's inappropriate.
It's just 100% cap is 100% of the market size. The Planning Commission's solution and recommendation based on today's numbers represent an 80% market opportunity. Alt 1, we already talked about, is a 54%. Anything above 50% was put in red because to achieve these kinds of numbers, it would require the resident population to essentially decline. Alt 3 is at 39%. That's the one that I presented. It is between the 33% we've been talking about and 50%. And the least restrict or the most restrictive is alternative 2. And now we have alternative 1A. Those are the most restrictive at 34 and 33%. So it's simple math there.
I understand. It's very simple math. That's misleading, Scott.
Let's go to the next page. I'll make this brief. So this is simply another view of side-by-side where we have the no cap, a summary description of the proposed plan, which I think is fairly self-explanatory. You see I have the asterisk there on the Planning Commission stating that the Planning Commission is based on applying recommendations to current day. Licenses were 26% lower of the recommendations were made.
We lost council members, peers.
We'll come back.
Scott reviewed this in case this would happen, but you can see that it lays out the alternatives. What the summary of the cap is just the summary, but the potential SPRs and ILP is the previous page, putting those numbers in place, but. Full-time residents excluded from CAP, if you look at it, the alternative 3 and alternative 1 both do that. The rest of the alternatives do not. And the same thing with a transferability in licenses to heirs, I think the Planning Commission one did. And alternative 3 put a proposal in there, not knowing exactly how that would be done, but that it would be
worked out some way to transfer to heirs.
So, you know, again, I as a starting point, I don't know where we're headed with this in terms of tonight, but I don't know how you couldn't, if you look at it from a resident quality of life standpoint, not look at option 3 being a reasonable place to start. It puts a reasonable cap on only 6%, leaves out 4%. It gives full-time, the full-time residents are excluded. And it offers some kind of transferability proposal for heirs. I think it incorporates a very, it tries to keep the balance, the historical balance across the island of what we always said is a third rentals, thirds second homes, and a third full-time residents. So I don't understand how if you're not associated with generating income or some way associated with the short-term rental industry, how you can be opposed to this if you're a resident. And I don't know where we're headed with this tonight, and I don't know if we're going to take a vote or what we're going to do. If we do, I'd like to make a motion that this be the proposal that we vote on.
Is that a motion?
I make a motion that we make as a proposal, alternative 3.
Second.
Give me a question, comment.
Yeah, just
just an observation of the years I've been here, it just seems like to me that this is just, this is a monster. It's just been created. It doesn't seem like to me it will never end. It just feeds upon itself, and which I've been here a while, but over three decades, but I don't remember a few years ago this being such a horrible, you know, discovery that we got this big problem. It's, we didn't have all these rental license applications until within the past year, and that's just really clear to me. And a lot of people that don't come to meetings, they stay at home, that they have made an observation. They say it seems like to me it just perpetuates itself. What's really scary to me is when I hear talk like, this is a reasonable place to start. So what's next? More restrictions until we don't have any property rights left at all. I don't have a short-term rental. Never will have one. I've just got my own little J.C. Long house on Hartnett Boulevard, and I'm not associated with any of that. And I don't, I just think it's a matter of, we just started our own hysteria, in my mind. This wasn't a problem a few years ago.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, there's a lot of good information we've gathered in all of this. There's no doubt about it. There's some things that we need to consider going forward as we work through this issue. I don't see that there's, in my mind, any easy answer. I think we still have a situation here potentially where we're picking winners and losers. We're playing with people's property rights. You know, whether they live on this island or off this island, if they own property, we're setting up a situation here. If we put an artificial cap in now, you know, that we are picking winners and losers, when we really don't know how the market's going to go. We don't know what the renewal on short-term rental license will be after they expire. And quite honestly, I am of the opinion here that we don't try to put any kind of cap in place tonight. So that's my opinion. I know this is just a discussion phase before we take the eventual vote.
Well, there's only two ways the rental license can go on the renewals. They either go up, for which we're too late, or are they going to go down, in which you wouldn't be impacted by the cap?
This ship does not turn quickly.
I think we could put controls in place and apparatuses in place and management in place, some of the things that we discussed, that we would have a good idea of where this island is moving at any given point in time, whether it's a report
monthly, quarterly, semi-annually, I don't care. I think that's something we would work out. So that's for another discussion, I guess. But for my comments on your motion, I'm not in favor of it.
Can I just make one more comment? This option that we're looking to consider, just remember, it does have enough headroom. It's already got another 113 licenses that could be issued up.
So as it's being discussed, it's really a guardrail.
Is now the time to go into executive session?
So
we can't discuss these issues in executive session without taking a vote.
What are the issues we need to hear after executive session?
I mean, I have a number of questions. Questions about things that are going on. Other islands. I have questions about legal ramifications. I have questions about a potential something I'd like to add as an amendment to that. I mean, there's a lot, and I've mentioned this, I think, at every meeting, that I'd like to be able to discuss this with legal counsel before we make any decisions. And tonight is the first time we've had that opportunity since we started talking about this. So
you could have a motion to defer the vote on the motion that's on the table until after you receive executive session.
I'd be willing to withdraw my motion until after we have executive session, if that would help.
That's another option.
Then I withdraw my motion.
Okay.
Councilmember Anderson, do you withdraw your second as well?
I do.
Yes, Janet, so you said yes. So suspend any further motions and go into executive session after the rest of the agenda.
You can continue the conversation, defer any votes until you receive executive session at the end of the agenda. That's an option. We can go into executive session now. We'd have to ask everybody to leave and then come back. So maybe you want to wait until the end to do that. Yeah.
Matt, you're suggesting wait to the end.
Yeah, I think under FOIA we need to wait and address it when it's dealt with on the agenda, which is agenda item number 9.
We took out our business a lot.
We don't need
that. I did not mean to end the discussion if we're still discussing, but.
Well, it does. It's we drew the motion.
Let's move on. So we'll just take that, table that to later and take care of the rest of the agenda.
That's right.
Most of these next few items have been discussed in workshop, so I think we can move through most of them fairly quickly. Approval of an amount not to exceed $18,000 for the purchase of AED defibrillators, and you can see where that's coming from a budget standpoint.
Motion to approve.
Second. Any discussion? Again, we've had discussion at workshop. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Item B, approval of replacement of 2010 Ford F-150 for fire department in the amount of $46,000 state contract pricing. You can see where that's coming from a budget standpoint.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item C, approval of replacement of 2014 Ford F-150 for fire department in the amount of $46,614 state contract pricing. Again, you can see the budget line.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Questions, comments, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item D, approval of an emergency replacement of police department patrol vehicle 502. Again, you can see the budget item. Desiree, just you want to have a quick comment on this one?
Yes, this is a new item. It was not included in your workshop agenda. This is a vehicle that was involved in a collision a couple months ago. It was totaled. We received from about $7,000 from our insurance company. It needs to be replaced. It's what's used as a backup car when another patrol vehicle is being worked on or has any issues. We need to have people on the road. So this is a replacement of that vehicle that was not scheduled to be replaced yet, but because of the accident, it needs to.
Great.
Do
we need a motion?
Yes.
Motion to approve. Second.
Other questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item E, approval of proposal from Davis and Floyd in the amount of $7,000 to design an emergency beach access path through Charleston County Park. Again, you can see the budget line item there.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Item F, approval of proposal from Rentalscape in the amount of $42,000 for short-term rental managing compliance software. And you can see the budget item there.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Other questions? Douglas, you want to just comment real quick that we'll run parallel?
Yes. We're currently running Granicus. We would like the opportunity for the next 2 months during the remainder of this license year to run this software next to Granicus to be able to analyze the differences if one is picking up significantly more properties, if it's better from an administrative standpoint. We would like to know that before we kind of jump ship all together. So this gives us a unique opportunity to run them together for a while. We would anticipate in the future dropping whichever one doesn't provide value going forward. So this, we have a temporary arrangement, just knowing we would go to one in the near future.
And look at some point the other modules that were out there once we decide where we're going.
Yes, I will say the 42 is kind of their base, basically their basic service. It doesn't include being the kind of front end and handling the licensing administration, which they offer. So it could be that if we like the system and we want to continue with it and use it going forward, that we would come back and add some of those modules down the road. But that would be probably middle of the year before we know that.
Other questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item G, approval of temporary parking agreement with Islander 71 for the use of the shared parking lot at the Island Feeding Arena.
Motion to approve.
Second.
There's a sheet, or a couple of sheets, a memorandum of understanding in your packet.
Desiree, updates or comments?
The memorandum of understanding essentially memorializes some of the topics we talked about at the workshop that would be in place just for this season. Remember, we are trying to gather data that would yield a good final plan for that entire part of the property along the intercoastal. In coordination with the restaurant, we would like to reconfigure the entire side of that marina, have the city have its own dedicated parking area. The restaurant would have their own dedicated parking area, and we would be going away from this shared concept, which is, you know, proven to be really problematic and difficult to manage. So our goal would be to have this temporary plan in place that will yield additional resident-only parking spaces in that section of the marina, and it would also provide resident-only trailer parking in that lot, just for those residents who have a decal in their car. So this would be, again, to take us through the season, allow us to get some more data, and ultimately come up with a more comprehensive and a separated parking plan for both the city and for the restaurant. Just wanted to clarify the two handicap parking spaces that are currently there right adjacent to the public dock will remain in place, so we're not reducing any handicap parking spaces, and of course any final or revised plan will take into consideration our requirements for ADA parking at the time.
And we have full agreement on this agreement at this point?
We believe so.
We believe so.
until it's signed.
Yeah. Other questions or comments?
Mr. Mayor, I would just say that, I mean, being on the committee where we've been dealing with this, just to get to this point, I think is a good thing, because we haven't had any real progress in working out a parking agreement down there. So I think us going through this process temporarily through the summer with an expiration date of what, I guess October the 1st,
yeah,
when the agreement terminates, and then getting together and working out some kind of a parking plan that works for everybody, all the marina tenants, and particularly the residents. A real win for us is we have much more free resident parking for trailers and for automobiles, golf carts, you name it, than we've ever had. So
all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. Item H, approval of increased hourly rate for beach service officers to $18 per hour.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Other questions, comments? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Item I, kind of in conjunction with our short-term rental conversation we've had, consideration of changing the budgeted part-time seasonal code enforcement position to a full-time position to match the one we currently have on staff.
Motion to approve. Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Item J, consideration of 2023 surfing applications. We have two, one from Shane Brannigan, second one from Kyle Bussey.
Busey.
That's in your packet. Go ahead, Desiree.
Yes, I do want to note that these are the first two applicants that we have received this year. As you all know, this was a change from last year where council decided to allow this activity upon your approval. We've reached out to everybody who had a permit last year and reminded them that we're starting the process again because a permit is only good for a year. Both of these applicants have selected locations along this end of the island, 6th and 9th, and I think you've already heard, and I've heard too, from some folks about the density of this operation in a short area of the beach. My recommendation would be if we received additional applications in the future and they specify that that's the location that they want to offer classes, that we deny that and require them to identify another location on the beach to address the concerns that we don't have all of the commercial operation on the beach and on that end. That is a path. We can ask one of the two that have applied to change their location. But I got that question earlier today, and certainly it's up to council to decide how to grant that permit.
Is that our choice or their choice that they're in one specific location as opposed to moving around the island?
We ask them to tell us where they plan to give the classes, okay, subject to our approval.
Depends on where they think is the best break.
Correct. I've served once and it wasn't pretty. So I would rely on them to tell us, if there's another location that would be feasible, as long as it's not concentrated in an area where you've already issued.
And there's plenty of
beach.
This is mostly teaching kids to surf, so they can pretty much go anywhere. There's not one. There's different breaks that are good at different tides, so that doesn't really, I think it's more just feasibility and ease of getting there probably more than anything. So I do think it makes sense to spread
just
that
to
out.
Add to that, I think some of the challenge, if there's one down there, I think it would be great. I don't know if you could spread the other two up and down the island, but there are only 61 designated spots, parking spots
on the avenues. And also, I think there's a requirement to keep swimmers within 100 feet of the surfers. So if they have two schools operating with about 10 students at the same time within two beach access points, that may get a little crowded in addition to the parking requirements.
So we just got the two. How many did we have last year?
Three.
We had three.
Yeah,
three.
This is Mr. Shane Granigan. It's a new operator. Kyle Busey has been offering classes for 2 years now.
How does that affect the
motion
amount
to
of,
approve? Second.
Okay.
I'd just like to ask, how does that affect swimmers in the area? I mean, is there enough? Does it crowd the beach up too much, or is it workable?
We limit the amount of students that can be in a class for that same purpose, and they cannot be within 100 feet of any swimmer. So if they go to a location and it's full of swimmers, they're going to have to move to another area and be away from folks on swimming on the beach.
And 10 surfers would take up quite an expanse of beach space, right?
Not really.
No?
No. Especially in lessons, because they have them all together. I mean, it's pretty tight.
It's also for 2 hours a day, so it's not kind of an all day.
And it's mostly foam boards, too. I mean, we haven't restricted them to that, but from what I've seen, it's mostly foam boards, which are not nearly.
Oh, okay. That's what I need to understand.
We've got a motion and a second. Any other questions?
Scott's done.
Yeah. Yep. No.
Scott,
I was just saying that we've seen the operators down there. They're pretty responsible operators, and I think they're very good with their students.
Other questions, comments? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item K, discussion and consideration of alternatives for the 30% state aid tax. We've got two items on the agenda tonight. We will start our IOP budget process next month. This summer, we'll have an approval for our DMO's budget at some point coming up through the ATAX committee. But first item, since our task force completed their work last year, the Attorney General opinion came out. We've got a new attorney, Mac McQuillan. Thank you for joining us tonight. It's your first time you've been able to attend with us. He was our city attorney. And Mac's had some experience with this particular topic. He is also the city attorney for Hanahan, who's gone through a recent look at the same idea. So I wanted to touch on two items tonight. The first one, we'd love to hear, Mac, your experience, opinion, view of current state law and the AG opinion and what you've seen with Hanahan, and specifically touch on the 30% usage, if you will, 30% bucket usage, if you will.
Sure. Thank you, Mayor Pounds. Good evening, members of council and everyone in attendance. So as everyone knows, the city uses the Charleston Area Convention and Visitors Bureau as its DMO. We have one currently that exists. That's our designated management organization.
the issue, I heard it come up in public comment, but it's been raised before too, about whether the city could create its own DMO. This issue actually came up, as the mayor mentioned, with the previous entity that our firm represents, and that was prior to this attorney general opinion that was issued on May 31st, 2022. But our law firm's reading up the statute, talking with tax lawyers, we basically advised them that we didn't think that was wise based on the way the statute is currently worded. Of course, you can go to your legislators and try to get a change to state law, but as the statute's currently worded, we viewed that as problematic, and it was also costly to set up the 501c3 fund and figure out how to organize that. Kiowa has also more recently discussed this issue and ultimately opted not to create their own DMO as well. The only entity that I'm aware of that has done it is Folly Beach, which was mentioned tonight in public comment. So going into this attorney general opinion, this was requested by the chairman of the Tourism Expenditure Review Committee, which a lot of folks refer to as the TURC. That's the state committee that has oversight authority over the accommodations tax. And so he writes Attorney General Alan Wilson and asks for an opinion. And the issue in that opinion was whether a municipality or county can create a nonprofit organization pursuant to Section 6410. You informed us that a local government wants to replace the Visitor and Convention Bureau that has been managing and directing the expenditure of its local accommodations tax for tourism promotion. So they basically go through the statute, go through law. The statute, for the audience, says the municipality or county shall select one or more organizations such as a Chamber of Commerce, Visitor Convention Bureau, or Regional Tourism Commission, which has an existing ongoing tourist promotion program. If no organization exists, the municipality or county shall create an organization. And so based on that language and analyzing the case law, the conclusion of the Attorney General's office was, and this is a quote, based on this language, it is clear that the legislature intended for a municipality or county to choose an existing organization that meets the eligibility requirements of the statute to manage and direct the expenditure of its tourism promotion funds. A local government is only authorized to create an organization when one does not already exist. And in the conclusion section, again, they say a local government is only authorized to create an organization when one does not already exist. And so I think based on the plain language of the statute, as well as this attorney general opinion, I think our hands are sort of tied there. The other thing I will point out, too, is the 30% funds that we're talking about that go to these DMOs, the statute is very clear. It says 30% of the balance must be allocated to a special fund and used only for advertising and promotion of tourism. And so I think there has been some misunderstanding. Look, we can get this money and use it to build restaurants and do this kind of stuff. That's not what the statute currently allows, though. Any questions on that?
Well, just a comment, if I can, Mr. Mayor. I've been dealing with a tax issues for the last couple of years here, basically. And it is very clear what the 30% can be used for. And we have that other pool, 65%, that we can do a lot of things with. And there's a lot of things that, a lot of good ideas out there. We've had them from residents, committee members, with our ATAX task force that we did, some recommendations from the ATAX advisory committee that we have in place. And I would say that we definitely try to explore that, those 65% funds, and see what we can do to really make a difference on this island, because it is a large pool of money we're talking about. And it is correct that we give out of our ATAX dollars a large amount to CBB for marketing and promotion. But I can tell you that, you know, they're working closely with the ATAX Advisory Committee. I've been listening to those meetings. Our ATAX Advisory Committee seems to be more open to the presentations that CVB has been having with them, you know, the disclosure of their budgets, working towards common goals to have more dollars that are set aside for Isle of Palms, to help Isle of Palms with different projects, whether it be a website. They've given some support to our fledgling Chamber of Commerce that is a 501c3 that we hope someday can get to the point that they can maybe take on some more local marketing responsibilities when they get a track record. And I think I think even though it's a large pool of money, you look around the world, and you look around Charleston, you see all these airlines coming into Charleston now that have been attracted here, where people are coming internationally, you know, and domestically into Charleston. You know, a lot of that was through a lot of effort that was done and through the CVB and through other organizations across the state to attract more tourists to this area. If you go overseas, someone asks you where you're from, I've done it several times. I never tell them Isle of Palms and have to spend 30 minutes explaining where Isle of Palms is. But if I mention Charleston, they know exactly where Charleston is. You know, and to me, that tells me that Charleston is recognized as a real destination throughout the world. And I don't discount that part of that, a great reason for that. One of the great reasons is the 30% that we contribute out of these dollars to help market the entire region, whether it be Charleston, Isle of Palms, Mount Pleasant, whatever, Kiowa. I mean, everybody gets the benefit of that, you know, from that expenditure of those 30% funds. But that other 65% pool, we've got plenty we can do with it, and we need to be creative, and we need to make sure we have committees and people in place on various committees that are really looking at what we do with that 65% and make good use of it.
Jimmy, thank
you. Rusty, I just have a question for you. What would you say to some residents that have talked to us in recent months and showing some frustration when they feel like that their written material and stuff that we're, they seem to point out there's not much mention of Isle of Palms. Can you understand there might be a little bit of local frustration with that?
Yeah, I can understand there might be local frustration, but I don't think that in that case there you're actually looking at the bigger picture. Now, do we get specific mentions of Isle of Palms in every publication that goes out? Every time Southern Living or Travel and Leisure or one of those magazines has an issue, no, we don't get mentioned in that, but the greater Charleston area does, and that attracts more people. When you get, you know, you're going to be making conscious decisions when you're coming to Charleston. Where are you going to spend your time? Maybe you don't spend it all in downtown Charleston. You're going to go to the beach. Maybe you stay at the beach for a couple of days. Those kind of things. Okay. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot more we could do, and honestly, I think based on what I've been watching with the Egg Tax Advisory Committees and CVB and the interaction between the committee this year and the CVB, that there's been a willingness on both sides to really explore those options.
Okay. I just think people are looking for a little bit more return on the investment.
I agree. I mean, specifically, $1 million out there, $1 million plus, we ought to be getting more return. I'm not saying it's perfect. It's not. This is the best thing we got going right now.
Okay, thanks. Mac, we have not had this conversation. This council has had some conversations. We've had conversations with our lobbyists. You know, to me, our energy and effort needs to be on that 30% number. You know, that was a great idea 30 plus years ago when these regional marketing firms were put in place. And but now you can't go anywhere in the world that somebody doesn't know where the Lowcountry or Charleston is. And I think if we could, you know, get a sponsor or two at the state legislature level to entertain reducing the 30% or capping it at a dollar amount, I personally think that's where our efforts would be better spent. And some of us have had conversations with our lobbyists around that topic. I've had conversations with multiple mayors around the state, you know, just kind of looking for kindred spirits. You know, that would be willing to join the fight with us on this. So that's a long-term game to get a state law change for sure. But, you know, I think that's where some of our energy and effort should be, in addition to continue with our APACS committee to hold feet to the fire on IOP specifics or metrics or whatever it looks like. So.
Yeah, I think we need to be forcing that issue a lot more. And Rusty gave a really nice speech on behalf of CVB. But I think that we all need to be a little bit more serious about holding their feet to the fire on this one.
Have you watched any ATAX Advisory Committee meetings recently?
It's getting better.
Watch it.
I think there's some good reporting coming back. Yeah. It's definitely light years ahead of where we have been a year.
Maybe just to add one more little bit of perspective, the dollars have gone from about $600,000 to about $1.2 million this year. So we're we've doubled in roughly 4 years the amount that goes into that 30%. I think to Phillip's and to Jimmy Ward's comments, you know, are we getting a bang for our buck, and do we really need to be spending $100,000 a month on promotion? Or we've got an opportunity with a lobbyist to maybe ask for some of that money to be diverted to longer-term infrastructure projects that support tourism instead of spending $100,000 a month on advertising.
Yeah, which is true, but again, I mean, current regs are very clear on what we spend it for. We'll get into item two, Scott, to that exact point with our lobbyist conversation in just a second. Jay, any comment?
I'd just like to say, too, that I definitely think the CDB is a good organization for regional Charleston. I just want to make sure that when all those tourists come to Charleston and they want to go to the beach, they know that there is a place called Isle of Palms where they can go. It's not Folly, and certainly not Sullivan's done one of them, not Folly Beach or someplace else. So we want to make sure that we are recognized. And I think one of the things that we're doing with the CBB is we've hired, I'm not exactly sure what the title of the person is.
Public Relations and Tourism Coordinator.
Okay. Which will hopefully solidify that, because one of the problems I think we have had with CBB is we weren't telling CBB what it is we wanted and helping CBB find information about who we are and what it is we want to promote ourselves as. And this person will help that, which I think is a big step forward. But the other thing I really like is what we're going to talk about next. I think $1 million, when they set up the legislation, they were most of the cities in South Carolina are not giving their CBBs $1 million for their marketing. It's probably, they were thinking more of the tens of thousands of dollars, not the millions of dollars. So I think there is some opportunity there to work with a legislative change. It just takes time. In the meantime, I think our lobbyists have come up with an idea that I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Mayor. You want to talk about that?
Well, just real quick to finish up on the communications, public relations person. You know, that is a job share, cost share arrangement with CBB. So that money is coming out of the 30% bucket back to us. You know, it's not huge numbers, but it's 40 to 50,000, give or take, would be their cut, somewhere in that range. So I think there has been good conversation so far to look at how to use that money. So to Jan's comment and Scott, yours as well, some of us were in Columbia 2 or 3 weeks ago at this point, and there was kind of a quick conversation with our lobbyists around the ability to use a budget proviso and grab some of that 30% back for infrastructure, tourism infrastructure needs on our island. Never heard of that suggestion before, never was aware of it at all, so it's an interesting idea, but it's a one-time budget adjustment for a specific project on IOP, tourism-focused, obviously. You have to have a legislative sponsor, so hopefully a Bustos or a Campson would help us out. It's got to go through the legislature, get approval. We're somewhere into the budget cycle. Our lobbyists, through conversations and some email traffic, have said, you know, we're maybe too late for this year, may not be, just depending on how fast we can move. And in your packet, there's also a list of potential projects. You know, again, if we're going to do $1.2 million-ish this year to the CBB, you know, I don't know what the magic number is that our lobbyists would feel comfortable doing a budget proviso for. Is it 200,000? Is it a third? You know, I don't know what that magic number would be. But when you look at, you know, we just need to be really careful, in my opinion, on these projects, the ones that our staff has identified. I mean, most are pretty big ticket items to some extent. Some aren't, but you know, we talked about beach access paths, which are roughly $250,000 each to build, and we've got a budget request at the state level line item in for $2.5 million for 10 of those to be built this year. So I just think we need to be really careful and strategic around this conversation and what we ask for, how we ask for it, and kind of when, if you will. So
I think when is to
is the key word there.
I don't know, but we're probably too late this year because they're deep into the budget.
Why do you say that, Jim?
Things move really fast in like January and February in the South Carolina State House and Senate.
Well, I can read what our lobbyists said, if you
that'll
like.
Be fine.
But our lobbyists don't think it's too late and said, so why wouldn't we give it a shot? I mean, why would we wait a whole other year when we have an opportunity? If we don't get it, we don't get it. But at least we tried. Why would we bypass a whole year and not spend, you know, with the opportunity to spend $400,000 here on the island on something, as opposed to saying, well, we're too late, when our lobby is saying we're not too late?
Well, I'd like to get argumentative. I didn't mean to start anything argumentative about it. But first of all, you have to identify a project. Do you have something identified tonight?
Well, let's pick one. There's five of them there. Let's just pick one and get one in. Anything's better than nothing.
Can I make a suggestion? First of all, we're not asking the state for money. It's our money. Yeah. We ought to already have that money. All we're doing is reallocating our funds. So I don't think it'll be a hard thing to get in a budget because we're not taking it away from anybody else. It's already ours, and it's just reallocating the funds.
Look at like the documentation we already started. We've already gone pretty far down the process. We're in the permitting phase. We're doing well on permitting, right?
Yes.
Rehabilitation.
Permits are in process.
Going well, and I mean, so you know, we have some things that are shovel ready or almost. I think. So
we've got plenty.
Why not take? We're taking space. No.
And the lobbyists told me that we don't have to have a very detailed plan. Just give them a project name and a cost projection or estimate. They'll take it from there. So all we have to do is say, we want them the docks. It's going to be roughly $400,000, and they'll take it from there.
I would just like to suggest that we give them a couple of choices. One that looks likely to be, you know, in the tourism kind of category. But I want to push really strong for a drainage project, which is not directly related to tourism indirectly, because if we flood, the tourists aren't happy, because we badly need drainage improvements on the island. We have a completed drainage master plan, which actually lists projects, costs them out, and we can pick and choose as many of those or as few of them as they give us money for. So I'd suggest you give them maybe a first, second, third choice or something like that.
I don't think we can do that, Jan. I think we got to pick one, we got to give it to them, and they got to run. Time is of the essence, and you're right. We are late into the budget, but they're not saying it's too late. And I think that the walkability study with construction of paths is a tourist-related thing that the staff has put together, and I'd like to see us move forward with that. I don't know the cost of that. We can say it's in their neighborhood of $400,000. That's what the lobbyists had suggested that we go forward with, is our number in the $400,000 to $500,000 range.
Did they say when the $400,000 will be funded?
Through the next budget cycle. So as soon as the budget's approved for the next budget cycle, we would get approval to spend that money on that for that project through that cycle.
It's
through that
next,
budget year.
You said next?
Next budget year.
It's spending our ATAX money.
What? FY 24.
Yeah.
24.
Yeah, exactly.
It is spending the state aid tax that is collected on the island, but it is the state law as it's written today requires that to be spent only on tourism promotion, but that's why there is a path to get an amendment to the budget that would give you greater flexibility to use it for a different thing.
Right. We need.
But without that, as you all heard, we're limited in what we can use that money.
But it's reallocating our money. It's not asking for money
that's right.
Can I just make a motion that we get back to the lobbyists with option number 3 of yours, the island-wide walkability construction of multi-use paths, sidewalks, and crossroads with a cost of approximately $400,000 for them to get a one-time proviso for in the budget cycle?
Where's that number coming from? Just what they think we could get approved.
That's exactly. They said, look, you don't want to go for all 1.2 million and, you know, do something reasonable. And they said, you know, I think $400,000 to $600,000 is a reasonable ask of your 1.2 million.
And then we would just decide of that, what that paid for, because obviously it's not going to be every sidewalk around the island. So we would just get.
Just projecting new sidewalks, new multi-use paths. It's not just fixing current. It's putting a whole plan in for the island.
Yeah.
The recommendation starts with just a study. Some engineers to look at walkability on the island, and then from that study, then we can pick what we could potentially construct with that allocation.
Just Kate, to your point, think about the Waterway Boulevard path.
Yeah.
You know, it's a million or two, three, whatever that, that
so
is.
So this is just to get us started.
Yeah, to kind of put a plan together, connect them appropriately, create some walkability on the island, multi-use paths.
And hopefully, if we got any dollars, I mean, you'd be able to use them if it spills over into another budget cycle, another year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the project's not if the lobby has been delivered, then once again, that's been a really good investment.
Yeah.
I think the original investment was $50,000, wasn't it?
We are hoping to get those folks here in March. They have a scheduling issue for their workshops with me and our council.
The lobby?
Say again?
The lobby?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What I would suggest is that we go ahead and apply, and if the islandwide walkability study and multi-use paths, sidewalks and crosswalks is a possibility. If we get it in the cycle now and we don't get it, then we're ready for next year.
Yeah, we've got a motion and a second. Other questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Item 7, boards and commissions report. Board of Zoning Appeals minutes are attached. Planning Commission minutes are attached. Accommodations Tax Advisory Committee minutes are attached. Environmental Advisory Committee minutes are attached. Mac, I didn't say this, but thank you. It's nice to have you. Item 8, ordinances, resolutions, and petitions. Second reading, none. First reading, ordinance 2023-01 to provide regulations for dogs biting, chasing, or attacking. This would be entitled only to the first reading.
Motion to approve. Second.
Questions? Title only, right?
So once approved by title only, it goes back to committee. This is something that was brought up by the Public Safety Committee last
week. Folks, can we have some quiet, please? Folks, can we have quiet? Thank you.
This is something that we discussed and brought forward through Public Safety at the end of last year. There was some issues getting it ready for January, so we're bringing it forward now. Upon approval at first reading, it's referred back to the committee again. So Public Safety will take a one-second look at the draft ordinance before it comes back for a second reading and ratification.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Item 2, ordinance 2023-02 to prohibit e-bikes and other motorized vehicles on the beach. Our public safety chair would like to defer this item and take it back to committee for further discussion.
All right, I've done a lot of work on this, and it needs a lot more in-depth study about what's going on. It's not as simple as it might appear on the surface. So I appreciate if we could defer it back to committee.
We don't need to vote on that, do we?
Yes,
we
please.
Well,
make a motion to defer.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Resolutions and petitions. Proclamation 2023-01 to celebrate March as National Red Cross Month.
Motion to approve.
Second. Thank you. There's a sample in your packet that was provided by the Red Cross. We did this last year. I think we've done it in previous years as well. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Last resolution is 2023-01, authorizing consumption of beer and wine at the Front Beach Fest on March 4th, 2023.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Want to think about it?
No.
That is this coming Saturday. Rec staff have been working really hard on getting that event. The weather's looking really good. It starts at 12 to 4 down at Front Beach. So I hope to see you all there.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Last item, executive session pursuant to South Carolina Code Section 30-4-70A2 to receive legal advice related to the noise ordinance and short-term rental regulations. Council may take action on matters discussed in executive session upon returning from executive session.
Motion to go into executive session?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. 909, off record.
Mayor, if we have folks that want to stay to hear what you all may decide after coming back from executive session, we can go upstairs and let them in the room. That way we're not.
Can they bring them back?
That's just an option.
Sure. That
works. We'll see you in 2024.
We're going to go on break.
You're going out.
You're leaving regardless. Yes. Well, just in case people want to stay. Yeah.